This is my town. Well, no, it's not really. It's Rick Smith's town, but Rick Smith is taking tonight off. I'm wondering what kind of fun we're going to be having in Pittsburgh next week with Rick making all these preparations. I'm sure it'll be a blast, and you're going to want to tune in because we'll be broadcasting from Pittsburgh all next week. And keeping an eye on what's going on all over the country and the world, but also letting you know what's going on right there in beautiful, beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're right now there in very big, could be in very big trouble. Very big trouble. How do you spell trouble? You spell it with an S, and S is for Santorum. Have you been paying attention to potential federal court justice nominees on president list? That's right. You heard the word Santorum and federal judge in the same sentence nominated by President Obama? Now, it's not going to be Rick Santorum, but it may as well be. Rick Santorum's former lawyer and conservative extremist David J. Porter looks like he's going to be handed a lifetime job as a federal judge. Porter is rather outside the American political and social values, at least the ones that we hold dear. There's a petition, by the way, that you can go, you just go to moveon.org. They're having a petition. And I'm no big moveon.org fan, but I'm glad they brought this to our attention, especially us Pennsylvanians. I mean, everybody in Pennsylvania should sign this petition. Everybody, because this is going to be a federal judge, oh, by the way, in Pennsylvania. And we need somebody who's going to be sitting on the bench that doesn't hate the environment. This guy hates the environment. That's just one of the things he hates. According to MoveOn.org, Rick Santorum's political career might be behind him. And I would say the word might is a pretty big word. I have seen ugly heads rear themselves, and I think his will be back. Not to mention his other rear that's rearing with the word. Never mind. Anyway, there's a secret deal, allegedly, between Senators Bob Casey and Pat Toomey that could lead President Obama to give Rick Santorum's lawyer a lifetime job. What in the world could Bob Casey and Pat Toomey be leveraging President Obama for? That's the problem with MoveOn.org. They say things like that, and then they don't tell you enough about it. And I'm not saying it's not happening, because President Obama, it's like the minute he got elected, bam, he went conservative. Anyway, the Western Pennsylvania District Court in Pittsburgh could be the new home for David J. Porter. May as well be Rick Santorum. He is against women. He's got a history of discriminating against women, against immigrants. He's not real fond of gays or bi people or transgender people. He is a big fan of the National Rifle Association. And tonight, later on the show, we're going to have a chat with some folks who, aren't. Of the Fort Hood shooting being a horrible, terrible tragedy, but this is the second, after all, and one of only, I don't know how many now, how many shootings, how many, 31,000 people die a year from gun violence. So we're going to be talking to some folks from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence coming up later on tonight, because it's just absurd at this point. And I'll tell you, you got to go to their website, Coalition to Stop Gun Violence website, because the details of this, of the Newtown massacre, oh dear Lord, and you have to read them. It's an assignment. You must read them, because you cannot make an informed decision about how gun control should be administered without understanding what's being done with guns in the United States of America. Anyway, so this guy's a big fan of the NRA, this David Porter. He is against bilingual education, and he's against the EPA. How can you be against bilingual education? You know, we have the only State Department that actually allows people to get hired that don't have to know more than one language. How can we send people all over the world to communicate with other people and have them not speak their language? First of all, it's stupid, because we don't know what they're saying. That might be handy. Send people to another country that, we know what they're saying in. Anyway, he's against bilingual education. He is a political extremist, outrageous, unacceptable. And anyway, Keystone Progress on March 25th, 2014, said that Senators Casey and Toomey are plotting a secret deal to nominate a Tea Party judge, that being this border dude. So check it out. As I said, everybody, nothing that touches Rick Santorum should ever hold office or be placed on a bench. I think that's a fair enough sentence. If it's been near him, worked for him, supported him, quite frankly, touched him, it needs to be out of office and off the bench. Period. That show that we had, I filled in Tuesday for Rick. I'd like to thank everybody who's reached out to me and to the two women I had on the show. We had two women on to talk about their upbringing in extremely fundamentalist families and how it impacted them and affected them. And, boy, that's the only thing people have been talking to me about for the last couple of days. I'm glad that it made people think. I'm sorry that it made people sad, and I'm sorry that it made people feel as though, well, they were afraid that there were a lot of people like this, that there was a lot of this going on, that misogyny, because that's really what it is, the disrespect and denigration of women, was commonplace, and they were kind of horrified. Well, time to stop being horrified and just do something about it. Time to actually say, holy Moses, this is, and you could say holy Moses. That was a pun I didn't intend. But time to really do something about it. A friend of mine sent me an article about Christian colleges that have sexual assault problems. I guess that's not really a big surprise. Every college has sexual assault problems. We don't hear about them because people don't want, the people that run colleges don't want the mommies and the daddies to say, I can't send little Billy or little Susie there because it's not safe. So every university and college hides as best they can the track record. I went to Boston College, undergrad. I went to Boston College, and, yeah, we couldn't get the skinny on it. I remember when this is the late 70s and early 80s, we actually had, like, little demonstrations. We also demonstrated apartheid. That's how old I am. But we had demonstrations about trying to find out just how safe it was on campus or walking off campus. I think, for the most part, college campuses are probably a lot safer than other places, but there is a certain leverage capability for teachers and professors that, and then there's a God factor that goes on. Well, you would think, I guess, you would think that it would be safer at a Christian university or at a religious university, but this story, this article that I received in the email, is the from the RH Reality Check, Reproductive and Sexual Health and Justice newsletter. Private religious colleges are rife with abuse. And in addition to that, some of these schools aren't even accredited to actually teach your kid. So they don't want a lot out about what's going on, just like no university does. But in addition to that, they don't want to be under a lot of scrutiny because if they can't sell you their education capabilities, then they're trying to sell you the safety capabilities. Oh, you can send your daughter here. It's really, really safe. Doesn't matter that she's not going to know anything when she gets out or any more than she would have if she'd just gone to a really good high school. I think the bottom line there, though, is you kind of have to throw out half of your science department if you're going to be a fundamentalist school, right? I mean, how are you going to teach paleontology if you're a religious school that believes in creationism? How are you going to teach all kinds of stuff? It's just not going to be possible. If you're a fundamentalist, extreme fundamentalist, then you know from Genesis that Noah had three sons, and his three sons had the races of man divided up underneath them, and one son that lost favor with Noah. Noah was kind of ticked off at him because Noah got drunk and naked and this kid laughed at him and didn't help him. You know, he got to be the guy who had the slaves. I mean, this is literally in the Bible. If you're learning that stuff, you're not going to leave college educated. You're not going to leave college more intelligent than you went in there. It's just not going to happen. So these schools are, they're a place that maybe is not a great place to send your kids. And that's what this article is about. But anyway, so that's just one of the things that I received in the mail or email in the last couple of days. And as I said, I'm really grateful to everybody who got involved and got into that show, because those are the kinds of dialogue that are going to make a difference. You know, those are the kinds of dialogue that are going to actually, you know, make it so our young women grow up with self-respect and self-esteem. Those are the kinds of dialogues that are going to make it so that our young girls are safe and that they learn how to say no, and they know exactly what they're saying no to. And, you know, I feel bad because I feel like it sounds like I've been picking on religion, and I'm honestly not picking on religion, because I have a story right here that is picking on science. So let me just get to that real quick. The EPA failed to disclose cancer risks to people that they were doing tests on. An internal investigation issued Wednesday found that the Environmental Protection Agency did not disclose long-term cancer risks and the small chance of death to, you ready for this? Human beings who volunteered to breathe diesel fumes. They got human beings to volunteer to breathe diesel fumes and other pollutants and contaminants in order to do a study on them. The Inspector General's report said that some of the people participating in the five studies that were conducted in 2010 and in 2011 were not told that there was a risk of this contributing to a decline in their health or even death. The reason, they said, is because the EPA manager of the study said that the cancer risk he believed was irrelevant because the subjects were only exposed to this for a two-hour period. First of all, I can't even imagine that. I don't think I could breathe diesel fumes for 5 minutes. But two-hour period, and he said that it takes a long time to get cancer. So they didn't have to tell him. So there you go. Maybe it's not religion that should be picked on or science should be picked on. It's people who decide they need to make someone else's choices. This director of the EPA tests decided that he needed to make somebody else's choices about whether or not they knew that they were getting exposed to a lethal chemical, a chemical that has had lethal impact. And why in the world were they doing the test in the first place except to prove that? All right. One more story before we go to our first guest, who is a wonderful woman, Susan Feiner. She's an economics professor from the University of Southern Maine. She's going to talk to us a little bit about Pennsylvania's privatizing their colleges, as well as the University of Maine's hatchet job they've given their professors. And then we're going to take a quick break, and when she comes back, we're going to talk about the economy and the raise in the minimum wage, Paul Ryan's new budget, which is absolutely stupid, and some other stuff. But first, I just want one more story. Hobby Lobby. You've heard of Hobby Lobby. They've been in the news a lot lately because they're the corporation that has brought to the Supreme Court the request not to have to fall under the Affordable Care Act and provide birth control, have insurance companies that provide birth control to their employees. Now, they don't provide the birth control. It's not like you go to work at the Hobby Lobby and you go in, you punch the time clock, they hand you a packet of pills or a bunch of condoms. No. They have insurance policies, and the insurance policies provide penicillin when you get sick, or if you have a lot of heavy bleeding and you're going through menopause, you might get prescribed the birth control pill, or you might be prescribed the birth control pill, so you're sexually active and you don't have babies. Well, they don't want the insurance company to have to provide that one medicine, even though a doctor has prescribed them. And because this corporation has a single owner, they want it classified as though he was a small business. Okay, allow me to explain how corporations work. Corporations are basically shelters. You incorporate so that if your company goes belly up or somebody sues you or you contaminate the drinking water of 300,000 people in West Virginia, nothing happens to your home and your car and your personal assets. They might go after the corporation, but you are shielded and protected. You cannot be shielded and protected from things like somebody coming after you because your corporation screwed them, and then turn around and say, oh, no, I'm an individual. I want my corporation to have my person sexuality and my religion. No, doesn't work that way. Well, Hobby Lobby wants it to work that way. They don't think it's fair. But guess what came out today, according to the Associated Press? Hobby Lobby has 401k plans featuring several mutual funds that invest in pharmaceutical firms that produce intrauterine birth control devices, emergency contraceptive pills, and drugs used in abortion procedures. They're wasting our money, first of all, in the Supreme Court. They're wasting our money. Those are tax dollars to pay that ridiculous Supreme Court, who I'd like to, like, take out and, like, fire anyway because of that stupidity they did just taking the limit off of campaign funds. Contributions now have no limits. But they're wasting taxpayer money litigating this thing, or whatever the heck you call it when you're in the Supreme Court. Because they're hypocrites. They have their money invested in companies that produce drugs that they use in abortions? Are you kidding me? Sorry. Come on, Justice Thomas and the rest of you. Throw this crap out. Anyway, I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith's got the night off. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, production of Diversified. You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Aggregate individual federal campaign contribution limits are gone thanks to Wednesday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling in McClutchin v. Federal Election Commission. The ruling dealt with direct contributions to candidates and campaigns from individuals and will likely increase the flow of money and its power in politics. The High Court ruled that total limits of $48,600 every 2 years by individuals to all federal candidates and campaigns is unconstitutional, violating the First Amendment. Separate aggregate limits on political party committee campaigns were also struck down by the court. Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent said that this decision doesn't uphold what in fact is a blow to the First Amendment and American democracy. Federal election law, still standing after this ruling, continues to ban direct corporate and union contributions to candidates. The limits struck down apply just to individual contributions. Chicago fast food workers protested McDonald's wage theft Wednesday at the McDonald's All-American game at the United Center. The Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago is fighting alongside the Fight for 15 campaign in an effort to raise wages for fast food and retail workers in Chicago. Three class action lawsuits in New York, Michigan, and California have been filed against McDonald's alleging wage theft practices. McDonald's made nearly $5.6 billion in profits in 2013. Three Toyota plants in Ontario will be voting soon on whether or not to join Unifor, Canada's largest private sector union. The assembly plants in Woodstock and Cambridge, Ontario, would become the first Toyota union shops in North America if the union wins the vote scheduled for next week. Unifor, formed in August of 2013, is a merger of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and the Communications, Energy and Paper Workers Union of Canada. SEIU 32BJ workers rallied in New York City Wednesday as 32,000 apartment building workers pursue a fair labor contract that maintains benefits while providing wage increases. A strike authorization vote was scheduled. The union, representing thousands of doormen, porters, and other New York City building workers, is ready to strike if talks with building owners break down. The current contract expires April 20th. A federal court challenge to Michigan's anti-union so-called right-to-work law will go ahead. The Michigan AFL-CIO will be allowed to make its case that the law violates the federal government's power to regulate private sector labor unions. U.S. District Judge Stephen Murphy ruled, though, that the state does have the power to stop the union security clauses that allow unions to require workers covered by collective bargaining agreements to either pay union dues or fees to the union. The Michigan AFL-CIO says the significant parts of the case challenging Michigan's right-to-work law are going forward. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I think what we did was reform the student loan program. We're not cutting money out of it. In other words, people aren't going to be cut off the program. We're just making sure it works better.
But I guess that's why they say every rose has its thorn. Just like every night has its dawn. Just like every cowboy sings his head, say its own. Every rose has its thorn.
And every thorn has its rose, which is why I have Susan Finer here to be the rose on the program for now. Hey, Susan, super economist, super person.
Welcome Thank to the you very much.
Welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Thank you.
I got to get his name out there so people know what they're listening to. This is the Rick Smith Show. Rick's got the night off. Rick and I are off to Pittsburgh next week. We're going to raise the H-double hockey sticks out there.
H-E double hockey stick.
Yeah, excited.
Well, you're not L7 or anything.
L7?
You don't remember L7?
No.
If you make an L with your thumb and forefinger of your left hand and a 7 with your thumb and your forefinger of your right hand, and you
then
put
you're
them
square.
Yeah.
I guess I am L7 really bad. Rick even came down the hallway to show me how to do it. Because I'm that stupid. Anyway.
It must have been a New York thing.
It must have been. Now I'm playing with my hands, and I forgot why I wanted to talk to you. Okay. So I'm excited because you're on till 10, and if people want to hear about the minimum wage and the economy and all the other ridiculous stuff and all that other junk, we are going to get to that in the next half. But we're going to go back to the university debacle. So I sent you the clips. I was shocked at how hard it was to find you the story on Pennsylvania privatizing the more profitable satellite campuses of Penn State.
Correct.
Because nobody's doing stories on it.
While the Board of Trustees and the powers that be of the Penn State system are saying that they need to sell them because they're not profitable.
Right, which is even funnier. But
there's no media on it. That's why I asked you the question.
Yeah, and there's no media on it. So I'm thinking, all right, I got a million things to do, plus Rick and I are taking off. But this weekend I'm writing the Huffington Post about it because it needs to be got out there. And the only thing I'm really happy about my Huffington Post, and if you go to my page, I get my own page. It's www.huffingtonpost.com/Pat-LaMarche. But I did a story on West Virginia, on the West Virginia water thing, on a scientist who got her hands on the chemical that was in the water after they said it was proprietary and they couldn't let anyone have it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I get like 1,000 likes, which means maybe 10,000 people read it, which in the world of a national news story is nothing, you know, when millions of people read the other stories. But somebody from the Wall Street Journal read it, and then the Wall Street Journal did a story on it.
And when the Wall Street Journal talks, people listen.
Because they are totally not L7.
Correct.
But
they have some hockey sticks.
They do have some hockey sticks, and they'll beat you to death with them if you don't pay attention. But so that's my only hope, is if I can get it in the, you know, the side door of the Huffington Post, maybe it'll get. I was shocked that it's just not a news story. And the fact that they fired a bunch of tenured professors last year, which is what I learned by doing the research for you, makes it seem as though, guess what? Privatizing the University of Southern Maine and the rest of them is on your list for next year.
Yep.
And they're hemorrhaging the expensive professors so it'll be cheaper to sell.
They're hemorrhaging the cheaper professors so that
when they get rid of all that expensive payroll, it'll look more
attractive to a business.
Right.
The thing is, if they sell it to a for-profit higher ed outfit, the for-profit higher ed outfit gets to carry with it all the accreditation that the original entity has. So it remains accredited by the accrediting bodies. Their business school is accredited. Their nurse, everything is the accreditation all transfers across.
Which is a joke.
Which is a joke, but the tenure contracts do not transfer.
Especially
don't ask me to explain how that can be.
Well, especially if they get rid of them first. Especially if all this bad publicity. All the bad publicity falls upon the university main system, right? Then in about 9 months, just like they're selling it here in Pennsylvania, they'll come in and say, oh, look, we have a hero. Oh, Rapunzel, let down your hair. Your hero's here. They're going to climb up Shippensburg campus and buy it. And they're going to climb up University of Southern Maine and buy it. And then all that stuff is going to be... And you know what really ticks me off about this? Because I've been in the media so long. I am ancient. I've been in the media so long that I remember in the late 1990s when Angus King, in the governor of Maine, the independent governor of Maine, sold off the not-for-profit insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened all across the country, and they said, oh, well, we don't need a not-for-profit. We don't even have a public option now, right? And
correct.
So they sold it off, and those not-for-profit insurance companies, they got all their customers without the expense of paying taxes. And so then they became a for-profit, and it's like buying something that built enormous...
Built with the people's blood, sweat, and tears.
And
working people paid the taxes for that stuff.
That's right.
And working... the whole thing, it is so hugely infuriating.
I'm so glad you understand economics, because I was starting to stop understanding myself when I was talking. But... But
it is infuriating. Two pages into any economics textbook on minimum wages or income, you just go, oh, my God, this is so infuriatingly frustrating. I can't believe that people have wasted trees and paper and ink writing this stuff down.
So what's the let's do a status. First of all, we spoke to you two nights ago, and you had just left a rally, and you've got great students that are sticking up for the professors because they want a decent education.
Well, they're sticking up for their want an education.
Yeah. So what's happening now? It's 48 hours make a difference yet?
48 hours. Well, there was a press conference yesterday. The city leaders of Portland said that they really want a vibrant, strong University of Southern Maine. It's essential to the region, and it's essential to the city, and it's essential to the state. However, they support the faculty and the staff, but they also support the administration, and they all agree that
I was married to them. You can't have everything.
And they are very, they understand that the cuts are very painful, but the cuts are important because when we come out on the other side, we're going to be sustainable.
No. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard.
Well,
this is the Portland City Council?
No, it was the mayor. Oh. It was the guy, it was the mayor.
The guy with the Irish name there? What's his face?
Brennan.
Yeah.
But it was also a gentleman from Carl something from the Regional Chamber of Commerce, Mark Swan from Preble Street, and Jan Hutchinson from Creative Maine. I think that's what it's called, Creative Maine. It's part of the whole emphasis on creative economy. So they want all that stuff, but meanwhile, creative economy, okay, so you laid off two theater professors and an art professor, and then Mark Swan was eloquent about how the long tradition that Preble Street was actually founded by a member of the USM social work faculty back in the 70s or 80s.
And they're getting rid of the social work department.
No, they're not. They're keeping that. But he talked very eloquently about the need to involve students in solving the problems of homelessness and poverty and, you know, things that we all care about, and that's right. But why then, and that's all part of being a metropolitan university, and that's wonderful, but the university just fired its only urban economist.
Wow.
Well, how are you going to do these things?
Well,
and
you know, I want to know, having spent my, you know, massive part of my career in the homeless community and working as a homeless advocate, why Preble Street even commented? You know,
well, I don't know. They put together this press conference because They want to express their support for USM. But, you know, I think there's some pretty heavy political guns at work here.
Yeah, that's whacked. See, you know, homeless shelters are quite generally the most skittish group alive because they have nothing and they're afraid they'll lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So where they should be the most, you know, loquacious and swaggering of anybody, because what are you going to do, make us homeless, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're the most frightened. And so for them to come out and comment, and I'm shocked at that, you know. And by the way, there is nothing that mitigates homelessness that could come from limiting education.
Huh,
I suppose
right.
That's a backward sentence, but if you want to limit homelessness, or better yet, get rid of homelessness, then
mm-hmm.
endorse every kind of education humanly possible.
That's right. Especially, you know, yes, higher education, but spend money on prenatal care.
Mm-hmm.
Spend money on early child education. Spend money supporting kids in the early grades, and have a decent after-school program,
mm-hmm.
and let people's parents work decent amounts of hours at decent wages
mm-hmm.
so that they can be home and be present for their kids.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, maybe they said it because they are keeping this school of social work. Maybe they felt like, oh, phew, we dodged that bullet, so we better get out there and say yay.
I don't know. I think Mark is a really great guy, and he works really, really hard, and
mm-hmm.
I haven't had a chance to follow up with him on this. But I plan to give him a ring in the next day or two.
Yeah, good.
I've known him for a long time, but it really was a almost surreal experience. So, so that's what's going on at USM, and Maine Public Radio today gave the chancellor, the chair of the Board of Trustees of the University of Maine system, and Rebecca Wickey, who is the VP for finance for the system, an hour on the air to lay out their platform and why this is such a crisis, and the faculty and the students were supposed to call in, and that's how we would be involved.
Wait a minute. They're not giving you your own hour?
No.
That's just... So can you do something about that? Are you going to call the...
I've had an exchange with Keith Shortall,
yeah.
And I have been a supporter of Maine Public Radio since I moved to Maine in 1995, and I think I need to reconsider that support.
I'm absolutely certain poor Keith Shortall has got his head in a vice. You know,
well,
it needs to go to the administration of that place, just like the administration, you know?
Well, the University of Maine system provides a lot of space and, I think, funding and informed and in kind to the Maine Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a little bit of pressure being brought to bear.
I'm certain of that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just so, you know, it's so disheartening. And public broadcasting's funding is like 10% of what it was at one time from
the
state.
Yeah, they've got 59 cents instead of USM, which has 52
yeah.
cents.
Well, I mean, and literally... Somebody needs to hold up the picture of Pennsylvania right now, because obviously it's a playbook. Obviously they're playing from the same playbook. And the privatization of satellite campuses at the University of Maine is the next step. And
mm-hmm.
and I can't think of anything worse than the privatization of public education is happening. There are charter schools here and in this area, in the Mid-Atlantic State area, that have no textbooks.
What do you need textbooks for? Can't they just put it on TV? And, like, they could, let's see, they could watch the History Channel to learn their history. And they could learn ethics by watching Survivor. And they could, you know, isn't that a show, Survivor?
Yes.
Where they're on the island?
Yeah.
And they could learn geography.
Oh, they could learn democracy there, too, because they get to vote each other off.
Exactly.
I'm on TV.
And they could watch, learn geography by watching The Great Race. And they could, let's see, what else? They could learn math by watching QVC.
Oh, yeah, but they won't be able to afford anything on it.
Doesn't matter. This was just math class.
I'm chatting with Susan Finer. She is an economics professor at the University of Southern Maine, a vanishing breed, a professor at the University of Southern Maine.
Indeed.
And I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to chat about the economy rather than about the fact that without colleges, we might not have to worry about that last nail in our coffin. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. In the wake of another tragic shooting at Fort Hood, conservative pundits were quick to blame gun regulations and Democrats for not allowing soldiers to carry guns on military bases. On Fox and Friends, co-host Steve Ducey made this claim.
Now keep in mind, it was back, I believe it was during the Bill Clinton administration, where they decided that men and women on base shouldn't be able to carry arms, even though they're trained professionals.
As the New Republic explained, it was a 1992 DOD directive issued under former President George H.W. Bush that established the rules limiting firearms on military bases. Bill Clinton didn't take office until January 1993. On Fox's America's News HQ, retired four-star General Jack Keane pushed back on that idea and explains why, in practice, arming servicemen and women on bases is not a good idea.
Can you imagine the first responders coming on a scene and there's people shooting all over the place and they have to determine who is friend and who is foe? The soldiers, they do know how to defend themselves, but they're not policemen. They are not trained to control a violent situation and de-escalate it.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been covering military photographer Bill Jones and his mission to record damage at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The 20-year-old Jones was not in tune with the historical significance of what he had been ordered to do, but he figured out from his senior officers that it was a big enough deal that he should develop his own personal set of photographs, though he knew they were to receive a secret classification. Jones was concerned about getting his set of photos home without them being confiscated by someone. He solved that by wrapping his 8x10s covered with paper around the barrels of two souvenir Japanese rifles that were nailed shut in wooden boxes. He then put 4x5 photos in the bottom of an ammunition box and stuffed his girlfriend's letters on top of the photos and wired the box shut. So join us again next time to see what happens stateside. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get an $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012, and his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to tell you. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. Rick's got the night off. Actually, he's right down the hall. But he is working diligently to get all the little ducks in a row for our trip to Pittsburgh next week. So I'm filling in, and he's very busy. And I'm very busy talking to Susan Feiner, who's one of my sheroes. She is an economics professor from the University of Southern Maine. She's smart. She's articulate. She knows what she's talking about. And people just better get out of her way right now in Portland because she's not taking any more crap. In the meantime, though, I am always impressed, Susan, when I hear someone say something that is already proven. Like, for example, Michelle Bachmann, that genius, icon, amazing Tea Party House of Representatives representative who said, maybe we should just try not having a minimum wage at all. Like she never heard of Haiti. You know what I'm saying?
So, well, like she never heard of the United States before 1937. That's when the minimum wage went into effect.
Wow, 1937. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's so stupid, but why is it? Well, anyway, so tell us a little bit about the history of the minimum wage, because I'd love to know that. And then I want to know why we're having so much trouble getting it raised.
The history of the minimum wage. Establishing the minimum wage was one of the pieces of hallmark legislation of the New Deal. And Frances Perkins, Maine's very own Frances Perkins, the first woman to be Secretary of Labor under FDR. She was also FDR's Secretary of Labor when he was the governor of New York, and he brought her to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And she had just a really excellent grasp of economics, probably because much of her training was as a social worker and as, like, industrial relations rather than in economics. But she did have a good, strong background in economics. And she understood that as wages fell and families get poorer and poorer, then more and more people in the family go out to work. So that actually made wages fall more because there's more and more people looking for work, and employers are constantly looking for the cheapest possible way to fill their workforce needs. But the thing is, if you think about this as a system problem rather than as a negotiation between an individual employer and a handful of workers, if one boss is successful in getting workers to accept a lower wage, well, yeah, that one boss, that one firm is going to experience a growth in profit,
mm-hmm.
right? Because their costs are going to go down. But if every firm does that and all the workers' wages fall, then the firms are not going to get higher profits because they're not going to be able to sell the stuff they produce.
Right.
That is the key piece of logic that conservatives don't understand. They are not able to generalize. They're not able to go from the specific instance of one firm achieving a profit enhancement by being able to force down their workers' wages. Because, yes, that's what would happen. If Verizon or if USM is able to break the union and get lower wages for the workers, then profits at that firm will go up because their costs went down. But if all the firms across the whole economy do that and the workers have less income, then the workers' income will not be enough to buy the stuff the firms produce.
Right.
So the firms will have produced all this stuff, but they can't sell it.
Well, If
they can't sell what they've produced, then they're not going to realize any profit on it.
But I read a Howard Zinn thing about how all you have to do in order to be the ultimate colonist is to have the third world at home. Because you expand into other markets. You sell the stuff in Europe, which is always, isn't it convenient? We're so mad at Russia right now, and we're fracking the living daylights out of the United States. Oh, you can't get your natural gas from Russia anymore? Just so happens we've contaminated a whole crap load of water to get you some. So here, buy ours. I mean, you know, the whole idea is to make it so that we've got poverty in the United States and we're selling to markets abroad, you know, like they have in China.
Mm-hmm. So there is, you're making it too complicated, Pat. It's actually much simpler than that. Each individual firm wants to face the lowest possible labor cost they can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what each individual boss sees as an important goal. But each individual boss is not responsible for the overall well-being of the economy. So they don't recognize that when they all pursue their self-interest, it makes everybody worse off.
Well, I am curious why nobody at Walmart has, like, called up anybody else at Walmart and said, we're the ones whose employees get food stamps and Medicaid. We're the ones who are now having collection boxes so that our employees can have Christmas dinner. If we paid $10.10 an hour instead of 7 1/4 or 8 1/4, if they're really good, they'd spend it here. Because
exactly.
We sell the stuff. I mean, that increased income would never make it out of Walmart.
Or, you know, it would make it out of Walmart because they'd buy some. Well, I guess Walmart sells gasoline in most places.
They sell everything. So, yeah, so Walmart would just take all the money back again. It's just like, I can't even figure out why they don't know that. It's just that the person might actually have some dignity or the ability to, you know, maybe select, rather than buying that crap at Walmart, to actually run screaming from work that night and go to an organic farmer and buy some chicken.
Or they might have the possibility of working two jobs instead of three.
Yeah.
You know, those are the kinds of things. And, you know, one of the really...
Oh, now you're talking quality of life.
Exactly. And the issues in the workplace, I mean, this is, first of all, about 50%, maybe more than 50%, maybe it's 65% of the people on who earn minimum wages are women.
Yeah.
So, and the reason that is because the lowest wage jobs are part-time jobs, and part-time workers have historically been women because the length of the workday and the length of the school day don't match up at all. And so it's very hard to work 9 to 5 if your kids are in school. So they've created all these jobs that fit, quote, mom's hours.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about the mom's hours so much, but the what about, for example, the issue of on-site daycare? Now, how is that related to minimum wages? Well, it's related like this. We have known since the 1980s that if there were on-site daycare, that worker retention goes up, training costs go down, and productivity goes up. So having on-site daycares would be really good for profitability. But it doesn't happen because a lot of labor relations is not about productivity, it's not about efficiency, it's about power and control.
Right.
It's about power and control. And having a low minimum wage increases the power and the control of bosses.
Yeah.
And so this is really a battle over who controls our lives. But that battle has pretty much been completely ceded to the bosses by the Supreme Court, which now says they can buy their politicians straight up.
Yeah, how about that, huh? The new ruling that says that there's no limit. You know, when I was running for Vice President of the United States back in 2004, as you probably know, the Maine Women's Lobby does I think it was a breakfast then. I don't know if they still do a breakfast or what it is, but they had a politicians like breakfast at that time. And they invited all the Maine candidates to be, you know, to have a chance to speak to the different people from the Maine Women's Lobby. And I was up on the stage because nobody else in Maine, well, only like a couple of people from Maine have ever run for vice president at all. Muskie, mm-hmm. Muskie being one of them, and Hannibal Hamlin, who ended up being the Maine governor and vice president under Lincoln. But so I was up on the DS, and I got a standing ovation at the Maine Women's Lobby breakfast because I said that the Maine legislature should have on-site daycare. How the heck can we get the kind of leadership, and it should be every legislature all over the country should have on-site daycare. We aren't going to get people elected to represent us that are anything like us if we eliminate everybody whose kids are little. You know, and you can't get young men or young women, especially young women, but young fathers either, to be able to run for office if they've got the same sort of time constraints and life constraints that the average parent of small children has. So we never have anybody with skin in the game on daycare. We never have anybody with skin in the game on elementary.
They don't have skin in the game because they have full-time wives.
Right.
Right.
But they don't have skin in the game because they have full-time wives. That takes their skin right out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've got that less than minimum wage worker at home.
I could not agree with you more, Pat. We see eye to eye on so many things.
Must be why I think you're so spectacular.
No, it's why I think you're so spectacular.
So 10-10, will that cause the economy to come to a screeching halt? In my opinion, it's $5 too
absolutely.
Low. But
I think it's $5 too low. It's actually like $10 too low.
Okay.
If the minimum wage had kept up with productivity, it'd be at about 19 something an hour.
Wow. Yeah, if it kept up with productivity, because we're more productive and we're making crap.
Well,
meaning crap wages.
The economy is each worker produces more stuff in an hour today.
Uh-huh.
Twice as much. The value of output associated with each worker is so much more today than $10.10.
Yeah.
If we were to make the relationship between minimum wage and productivity today what it was in 1968-69 at the height of the value of the minimum wage, we'd need to be at about somewhere between $19 and $20 an hour.
Can you talk just for a minute, because I have someone who just wrote to me that is listening right now and listening to you and loving it, by the way. And she has been in and out of homelessness a bunch of times, which is how I got to know her, in and out of homelessness a bunch of times because of her low income, you know, her low wages. And, you know, she gets a home for a while, and then, you know, it ends up that she can't keep it after 6 months or a year, and she, because, you know, poverty is just... It leaves a nasty long-term impact. So she keeps going in, and then she ends up in a shelter, or somebody will help her with a hotel for a while, and then she gets back on her feet a little bit. The cost of paying such low wages, it's more than just people don't have any money. It costs the community.
That is absolutely correct. And that's one of the Europeans have come up with a very, very interesting policy term. It's called social exclusion. And they talk about homelessness and low wages and dropping out of school and criminal behavior and stuff as measures of social exclusion. And they talk about having a minimum wage that promotes social inclusion. Okay, so that you're able to participate fully in your community. It's also very important to point out that the United States is the only advanced industrial country that sets an absolute, it says, if you earn less than, I think it's $13,000 a year and you're a single person, that you're poor. $20,000 a year and you're poor if you're a family.
Yeah.
Whereas the European countries set poverty limits as as relative to the median income. So
right.
If the median income in your country is $40,000, then they would set their minimum wage so that a full-time worker would earn $20,000 a year. Okay?
Yeah.
So that the poorest working person would only be half as poor as the median person. We don't do that at all in the U.S. In fact,
they don't have CEOs that make 400 times what that low wage worker makes either.
That's true too.
You know,
they also have more unions and a lot of other things.
I got to tell you, one of my favorite quotes, and I'm going to destroy it right now, but Kurt Vonnegut, so it's close but not exactly. Kurt Vonnegut said, judging socialism based on Stalin is like judging Christianity based on Hitler. I know, isn't that great?
He was a great guy.
I know, I love him. I have another person who just wrote in real quick. You're causing me to get, and I just want to have what they're saying up there. I'm listening right now, and in order for me to go to work and make minimum wage when my husband is working, I'd have to take home minimum wage. I think she means she'd have to make $15 to $16 an hour to pay for her daycare.
Correct.
And so just to take home minimum wage.
Yes. And so there's a direct contradiction then between women being in the workforce, not providing child care, and having a minimum wage that's so low. It's a penalty that reinforces this horribly patriarchal division of labor, because if you've got two people in a family and one person earns $25 an hour and the other person is going to earn $10.10 an hour, but that's not enough to cover the child care, then who should who should take care of the kids?
Right.
The person earning $25 an hour or the person earning $10 an hour?
Right.
So the, quote, choice for women to step out of the workforce when they have kids who need care is not a choice at all.
But when you're talking about the households in poverty, they are predominantly led by women. And
mm-hmm.
so now we've got one wage earner, the single wage earner in the family is making that crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 70% or 75% of the 5 or 10 worst paying jobs, I can't remember right now, I think it's the 10 worst paying jobs that have been made in the last 5 years, are the 75% of them have been taken by women. So even when they're getting back to work, even this lower unemployment.
Well, the 20th lowest paid occupations in the United States are occupations where more than 75% of the employees in the occupation are female. I think that's what you're trying to
say. Thank you.
And
translating. You're the Pat Whisperer. Hey, I'm running out of time. I got like 20 seconds left. I am going to post your A Modest Proposal for Saving the University of Southern Maine. It involves marijuana column up on the Rick Smith Facebook page. I love you, Susan Feiner. You'll join me again next time I'm on?
I hope so.
Okay,
give me
great.
A call.
All righty.
I'll talk to you soon, Pat.
Yep, thanks. That's Susan Feiner, professor of economics from the University of Southern Maine. And she really knows what she's talking about. And I wish that, you know, people in charge would listen to people like that. But those are the things I hope for. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back. 97 families, lost 97 farms. I think about my grandpa. My neighbors and my name. It's nice to be like that.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Aggregate individual federal campaign contribution limits are gone thanks to Wednesday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling in McClutchin v. Federal Election Commission. The ruling dealt with direct contributions to candidates and campaigns from individuals and will likely increase the flow of money and its power in politics. The High Court ruled that total limits of $48,600 every 2 years by individuals to all federal candidates and campaigns is unconstitutional, violating the First Amendment. Separate aggregate limits on political party committee campaigns were also struck down by the court. Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent said that this decision doesn't uphold, but in fact is a blow to the First Amendment and American democracy. Federal election law, still standing after this ruling, continues to ban direct corporate and union contributions to candidates. Limits struck down apply just to individual contributions. Chicago fast food workers protested McDonald's wage theft Wednesday at the McDonald's All-American game at the United Center.
The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago is fighting alongside the Fight for 15 campaign in an effort to raise wages for fast food and retail workers in Chicago. Three class action lawsuits in New York, Michigan, and California have been filed against McDonald's, alleging wage theft practices. McDonald's made nearly $5.6 billion in profits in 2013. Three Toyota plants in Ontario will be voting soon on whether or not to join Unifor, Canada's largest private sector union. The assembly plants in Woodstock and Cambridge, Ontario, would become the first Toyota union shops in North America if the union wins the vote scheduled for next week. Unifor, formed in August of 2013, is a merger of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and the Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union of Canada. SEIU 32BJ workers rallied in New York City Wednesday as 32,000 apartment building workers pursue a fair labor contract that maintains benefits while providing wage increases. A strike authorization vote was scheduled. The union, representing thousands of doormen, porters, and other New York City building workers, is ready to strike if talks with building owners break down. The current contract expires April 20th. A federal court challenge to Michigan's anti-union so-called right-to-work law will go ahead. The Michigan AFL-CIO will be allowed to make its case that the law violates the federal government's power to regulate private sector labor unions. U.S. District Judge Stephen Murphy ruled, though, that the state does have the power to stop the union's security clauses that allow unions to require workers covered by collective bargaining agreements to either pay union dues or fees to the union. The Michigan AFL-CIO says the significant parts of the case challenging Michigan's right-to-work law are going forward. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Get the party started on a Thursday night. Hey, I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show. Rick's getting us all ready, packing the car. Hopefully lots of snacks and yummy, tasty, salty treats. We're headed off to Pittsburgh next week. We're going to be broadcasting from Pittsburgh. Really looking forward to it. Hoping if you're going to be one of those folks out at the AFL-CIO event that we're going to in Pittsburgh, I hope that you come by and say hi because we got some fun stuff. We got some really cool promo cards for the new book that'll be coming out. We've got some neat stuff. And, well, quite frankly, you should go to the Rick Smith website right now. Go to the Rick Smith website right now and click on to be a supporter of the Rick Smith Show because, you know, the really rich, they just got a really big handout today from the Supreme Court of the United States. I should have said the Supreme Court of the 1%. The Supreme Court of the 1% has handed the wealthiest in this country the ability to make a contribution without limit. And that's a big problem. And the only thing is I love to quote Jesse Jackson, who's one of my favorite speakers and really a good guy. I can't imagine what his life would be like if he hadn't been standing next to Martin Luther King Jr. when he had his head blown up, which, by the way, the anniversary of that is tomorrow. The assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. happened on April 4th. But Jesse Jackson said that there were a bunch of little scraps of fabric in his grandmother's house. He was very poor growing up. Little scraps of fabric in his grandmother's house. Not one of them would have kept him warm. But when they stitched them all together, his grandmother stitched all those little scraps of fabric together and made a blanket, and he was warm. And that's what we got to do. We got to knit ourselves together. So if you got 5, 10, 25 bucks, and you can throw it in the Rick Smith Show, make a pledge to do it every month. You know, as our last guest, Susan Finer, just said, the public broadcasting system is now endorsing the wholesale firing of a crap load of teachers and professors. You can't count on broadcasting that you don't own yourself. And the people don't own public broadcasting anymore, but you can still own the Rick Smith Show. So get on there and make a contribution. It'll be a good thing for the continued health of the United States of America, hopefully the improved health of the United States of America, if we survive the environmental degradation facing us. John Atkison is joining us, regular friend of the Rick Smith Show. Hey, John, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Thanks, Pat. Good to be here.
Hey, I initially contacted you about one thing, but there were like 7,000 things that came out environmentally in like the 4 days since we chatted. So I think the most important one is the UN just said, hey, cut it out, and kind of on the same day that we said, hey, let's ramp it up. Can you do a better job of describing that than I did?
Well, you know, the
anybody
problem,
could. I I'm set the bar really low.
you know where I live. The problem with the Supreme Court is that is not that it's new. It's just that it's pushing farther and farther. There are fewer and fewer controls on how much money the big fossil fuel companies can put into politics.
There's no limit now, right? Wasn't that the final nail in the coffin?
Well, there's some limit still on the per-candidate basis. What they did was there used to be a limit on how much per year, per election cycle, that the super-rich could plow into candidates. There's still a little limit on the per-candidate, but now they can buy as many as they want.
Yeah, that's
there's
a
no limit on the aggregate amount, which means they can finance, 10, 20, 1,000 candidates. And, that's just a scary prospect.
But they only need to buy, 585, right? Then they have the Senate and they have the Congress.
Well, luckily, we do have some people who are reluctant to be bought, like Bernie Sanders on the federal level and a few others. And, I hate to say this, but it's sort of just dumb luck that we have those people because the system works against them. And, of course, the fossil fuel companies, the oil, gas, coal companies, they have wrangled over the decades to put themselves at the very center of our economy, which means we are forced to give them our money in order to be able to get to work. And then they take some of that money and they buy the politicians with them. I mean,
they also talk our Congress into giving them subsidies so they don't even have to spend their own money buying the politicians anymore. They spend the taxpayers' dollars, tax dollars, in addition to the profit dollars. Now,
however you dress up, it's still a pig.
You know, Vermont is where Bernie Sanders comes from, and it's a little bit of luck that Vermont's got Bernie Sanders, but it's a lot about Vermont, too. And Vermont is the only state that has it illegal for their legislature to pass a law affecting the people unless they have a public hearing. And they just have a lot of stuff going on in Vermont that, unfortunately, is extremely unique to Vermont, you know? And so it's ironic, really. And people say, well, why isn't New Hampshire just like that? Well, the reason New Hampshire isn't just like that is because New Hampshire has no income tax, so it's the playground for the rich people that work in Boston. So the rich, selfish people from the Boston area buy their homes in New Hampshire so they don't have to pay any income tax and do that little 30-minute commute. And so
right.
So that changes the electorate a lot. You're not commuting from Vermont. That's just absolutely for sure. Anyway, so the UN, I want to talk about the UN report, though, for a minute. The UN report says that climate risks go beyond red alert, is the headline from NBC News. Disasters such as the killer heat waves in Europe, wildfires in the United States, droughts in Australia, deadly flooding in Mozambique, Thailand, and Pakistan, who cares about them? These Nobel Prize-winning group of scientists have released a massive report this past Monday, saying the dangers are going to worsen as climate change gets even worse. Sitting ducks is what Princeton University professor Michael Oppenheimer, interesting name, said we are.
Because he's been around doing this for a long time. I mean, for decades.
So we're not listening. Like the tar sands pipeline is getting shoved down our throats, all these other things. The UN, who, thank God for the UN, is saying, wait, we're past red alert. If you were Captain Kirk right now, you'd be jettisoning the away pods.
Beam me up, Scotty, that's not looking too good down here. Well, you know, the funny thing is that it's the United Nations initiated and sponsored group, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and there's a couple of interesting things about that. What most people don't realize is most of these people work volunteer. I mean, you have the very top cream of the crop, scientists, who are working on this frequently, extra hours to get this done. But they call it the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for a reason. It is a governmental body. So when the United States delegation goes, it's not just our top scientists to these meetings to talk about their papers and what the consensus will be
and what they will tell the world. It's also their governmental, for lack of a better word, minders who are there to remind them, remind the scientists that it's not just science, it's politics.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts to get screwed up.
Well, and as we started this out talking about the Supreme Court, it's not just politics, it's money. So don't these people realize they live on this planet, too, or are they really deluded? I did hear a public broadcasting report that said this really will impact the billion poorest people in the world. That's who's going to be in trouble first. And so who cares? Most of them are going to starve to death anyway, so this is just going to accelerate their demise, and better they should die and decrease the surplus population.
Well, the using New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina as the exemplar for this process is helpful, because there was great devastation and many of the hundreds of thousands of climate refugees that had to leave South Louisiana and leave New Orleans, they were the poorest of the poor. But at the same time, the same event busted the levees in the neighborhood where I went to church, and that was Dr. Lawyer neighborhood, and you had rooftop rescues, you know, from expensive homes. And you might have had our president then, who was from Texas next door, who had an attitude about New Orleans, you know, letting it all go to hell, but everybody eventually suffers, even though the political right wing uses this divisive tactic of getting people into the attitude that, oh, it's just poor people. We need to have fewer of them anyway. It eventually comes back and bites you on the butt, and only the cream of the cream, the one-tenth of the 1% on top, can afford this delusion that they will be able to have this Elysium, this escape where they will not be affected. In fact, they will be affected. And except for the sociopaths and the psychopaths, sooner or later it's going to dawn on them.
Yeah. Now, that's one of the frightening things, though, about this new UN report, is that they said that things are worse than they had predicted in 2007. And when they mean worse than they predicted, they mean horrible. And when they said, this is a quote, the horrible is something quite likely, and we will not be able to do anything about it.
And this is the thing that makes me crazy, or since you know me, I have to admit, crazier, is that what the situation we are in is a very, very clear, well-documented, I's are dotted, T's are crossed. We know what's going on, and yet it's like driving at full speed ahead in pitch black, knowing that somewhere out there there's a cliff.
Yeah.
And we're headed in that direction, and nobody's hitting the brakes. It's just nuts.
John, I kind of commute to Indianapolis now, right? I go back and forth. I go there like once a month because that's where my kids are, right? So I come back from Indianapolis on, you know, through coal country, which is just about as impoverished as you can possibly get in Pennsylvania. There are billboards with a clown laughing, right? And I drove through snowstorms this winter, snowstorms, ice storms, everything, you know, just whiteouts, blizzards. And the clown laughing on the billboard is like, how's the global warming doing? And you know, they're talking these impoverished people that are in the shadow of these billboards into believing the word warming means it's a lie.
Yeah.
So what do we do about that? I mean, I'll tell you, I'm purple in the face, as I know you know, from arguing back. You don't understand the climate change. It's not you that's warm. You know, it's just like they thought the Earth was flat because it looked flat. You know? I mean, you try to talk to these people. Huh?
Back in the day, even when it looked flat to the folks who lived on the plane, the ship captains and the crews that went out on the ocean, they knew better. They knew that it was round because they could see the mass of the ship or the towers in the town recede over the horizon. They had this figured out way before Columbus. but there were still some knuckleheads in the royalty and in the church, which was almost the same thing then in Europe,
yeah,
who insisted that what was real wasn't real.
The so it's just like now.
The amazing thing is that so many people actually have a grip and a generally good idea of what's going on. They don't understand a lot of the nuance, and they're sort of uncertain about a lot of things, but they know what's going on. And this in the face of a immense propaganda campaign, bluntly, that includes those clownish billboards and radio and TV and so forth. But opinion poll after opinion poll, even out here in Nebraska, shows that majorities of people understand what's going on. So the difference between what people know and what they want and what should be dealt with and what the political system can deliver, there's this immense gap. It's this chasm. It's an abyss.
Well,
it's just crazy making.
I got to hand it to the oil companies and the gas companies. I got to hand it to them. I mean, I've got to throw myself down on my knees and genuflect and bow low.
Oh,
because
I've got something else I'd like to hand them, but that's all right.
But because they have made us accomplices. They have convinced us. Oh, I want my SUV. No, I really didn't like the weather this year, but son of a gun, I want to drive to, you know, I want to drive to the beach this weekend. And so instead of anybody thinking beyond that, oh darn, I'm an accomplice thing, and saying, oh, you know what, I'm just going to start demanding a light rail so that I can get back and forth around places and I don't have to drive myself. First of all, I can read a book or watch a movie, or I got everything in the world on my phone, right? I can have a better quality of life because I'm not in this little metal cube driving myself all over the place. Instead of actually saying, why don't I have a better system to work by, I'm guilty because I'm one of the people boiling the earth right now. And that's what they've convinced us.
Yeah, but see, that only works if you don't go back far enough up the chain to realize that these bloodless sociopaths have managed, just out of sheer greed and manipulative ability, to put themselves and the fossil fuels at the center of the economy. We've got to depend on them. How are you going to get to work if there's no mass transit except you buy yourself a car or sometimes two, three per household? It's crazy, but it's what you have to do to get to work. And if you don't get to work, you don't pay the mortgage, you don't pay the car payment, you're not on the right treadmill. You know, it's just, again, crazy making. So
I don't have a car, and people think I'm crazy. You know, I walked to work tonight. It was raining. I got wet. That's the way life goes when you don't have a car, right? I mean,
and you didn't melt.
I didn't melt. Like a little sugar cube or a wicked witch. Neither one. Okay, so I'm putting you on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot right now with 30 seconds. If people want, 30. If people want hope, because I have to talk about a medical clinic that's closing in town, or not closing, but lost all its doctors. It'll still be open though. But if people want to have hope, what website do they go to figure out what to do next?
Gee whiz.
I know.
It is a complex question. They should look me up on Facebook.
Okay.
John Climate Hawk. It's an ATKEISON.
He's one of my friends, John Climate Hawk Atkinson. You can go to me first and find him.
And but there is a tremendous range of resources. But the main thing is get rid of the dirty stuff like coal and oil and gas. Use the clean stuff. Did you know that wind power, large-scale, utility-scale wind power, is now cheaper than coal-fired electricity?
Wow, that's great. And first industrial offshore wind farm was the paperwork was put in today in Rhode Island. It will be the first one if it goes through, so keep your fingers crossed. John, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Patty.
I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about Sadler Health Clinic. Coming right up.
America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. In the wake of another tragic shooting at Fort Hood, conservative pundits were quick to blame gun regulations and Democrats for not allowing soldiers to carry guns on military bases. On Fox and Friends, co-host Steve Ducey made a claim.
Now, keep in mind, it was back, I believe it was during the Bill Clinton administration, where they decided that men and women on base shouldn't be able to carry arms, even though they're trained professionals.
As the New Republic explained, it was a 1992 DOD directive issued under former President George H.W. Bush that established the rules limiting firearms on military bases. Bill Clinton didn't take office until January 1993. On Fox's America's News HQ, retired four-star general Jack Keane pushed back on that idea and explains why, in practice, Army servicemen and women on bases is not a good idea.
Can you imagine the first responders coming on a scene and there's people shooting all over the place and they have to determine who is friend and who is foe? The soldiers, they do know how to defend themselves, but they're not policemen. They are not trained to control a violent situation and de-escalate it.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been covering military photographer Bill Jones and his mission to record damage at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The 20-year-old Jones was not in tune with the historical significance of what he had been ordered to do. But he figured out from his senior officers that it was a big enough deal that he should develop his own personal set of photographs, though he knew they were to receive a secret classification. Jones was concerned about getting his set of photos home without them being confiscated by someone. He solved that by wrapping his 8x10s covered with paper around the barrels of two souvenir Japanese rifles that were nailed shut in wooden boxes. He then put 4x5 photos in the bottom of an ammunition box and stuffed his girlfriend's letters on top of the photos and wired the box shut. So join us again next time to see what happens stateside. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? Ask Me members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in her wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned.
Well, the house isn't burning, but somebody's smelling smoke. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. Rick's in the back of the scene here, getting ready for our trip to Pittsburgh next week. I hope you tune in here. We're going to be broadcasting from Pittsburgh. We're excited. We're going to the AFL-CIO shindig, and we'll have all kinds of great guests. We'll be sending those programs right back here to Central Pennsylvania. And first, though, if you saw the newspaper yesterday, five Sadler being, of course, the low-income health center downtown Carlisle right there on North Hanover Street. The five docs that work there are leaving. That leaves a couple of nurse practitioners, which, by the way, are probably some of the smartest and hardest-working people in all of the medical field. Nurse practitioners can do a lot of what doctors can do. They can diagnose conditions. They can prescribe medicines. But there aren't going to be any docs there anymore. And there's not a lot of information. The Carlisle Sentinel says that Ken Green, who has been there, he's taken over as the executive director. He's been there just a few weeks, 5 weeks or so on the job. There's not a lot of information that he's sharing, and maybe that means there's not a lot of information that he knows. But I thought it might be real good just to take a few minutes tonight. We only have a few minutes to do it, but and find out just exactly what Sadler does and what it has done. Some people are blaming the Affordable Care Act for this because hospitals have been told they have to open clinics, and so that's why we have health clinics springing up all over the place because people aren't supposed to be using emergency rooms anymore. But for years and years and years, Sadler has been a great resource for people who have had nowhere to go but have had health care issues, including dental issues. And if you think dentistry is a luxury, you're crazy. go right now and, like, tie a tooth to a door and slam the door if you don't need it. You know what I mean? If you can't have a good smile, how are you supposed to have a good job? So everything from dental health right straight through. And joining me right now is one of my absolute favorite people in the whole wide world. I met her back in the day, and one of the reasons that we know each other so well is because she got ill. She went to the hospital. She had health insurance at the time. She got ill. She went to the hospital. When she got out of the hospital, she didn't have a home anymore. At the time, I was vice president at Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter, and she came to live with us. And she's one of the most talented, incredible, wonderful people I know. And after she lost her health, she lost her health care, she lost her job, she lost her health insurance, and there was only one place for her to turn to get the kind of medical care that she needed, and that was Sadler. So, Mary Parks, thanks for joining me tonight on the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mary, so you went from being a person who had health insurance, had a job, had a place to live, to losing it all in about the span of 3 months. But your health didn't necessarily improve. So,
oh, no.
How easy was it for you to, now you've got no health insurance, how easy was it for you to get into Sadler, and what kind of care did Sadler provide?
Well, it was easy to get through applying to get into there.
Mm-hmm.
It took a little longer to actually get to see a doctor, only because there's such a need for the services that they provide, and there's only so much available resources.
Yeah, it says in the paper that they have 9,000 patients, so they have five doctors and two nurse practitioners for 9,000 patients.
Yeah, so you can imagine that it took a little while to actually connect with a medical professional in person there. You know, and, I mean, my experience with them overall has been, you know, as good as can be expected under those circumstances. The people there are great. Just terribly overworked only because of, you know, the sheer numbers.
Right. Now, I also noticed that they have a $5 million budget, which, when you're talking about providing health care to 9,000 people.
Yeah, that,
you know,
I'm not the greatest at math, but I know that that's not a lot.
It's about $550 a person.
Cause yeah.
I am good at math.
Yeah.
So they're spending, you know, that little bit of money providing health care to that many people. So, five doctors gone. If there was a line, what would you say? You waited maybe 6 weeks to get an appointment? Would that be a fair thing, or was it more like 3 months?
I think, if I remember correctly, this has been a little while now, but I want to say the 4 to 6 weeks was roughly what it was. I mean, and they, you know, they told me going into it that it would be some time.
Yeah. But that's not bad. And I used to go over there with residents at the shelter when they got something that was severe, like something came up. And they would get them in as timely a fashion as some, you know, when I go to my doctor. If I call and say, hey, I got flu, you know, they might get you in that day. They might get you in the next day at for-profit medicine. So Sadler's a not-for-profit organization. I'm sure there'll be more investigation as to where these five doctors are going. I guess one or two of them are taking jobs locally. I imagine it could be something as easy as the fact that Sadler just doesn't pay well.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly from the article, I believe that two of the doctors are actually a husband and wife who are simply moving.
Yeah.
So it could be something as simple as that.
Right. It's the whole idea that all five of them are leaving at the same time that, A, looks like something bad happened, and, B, just makes it like, oh, my God, you shake your head. It did also say that they would be hiring a couple of nurse practitioners, and I love nurse practitioners. I've gone to them for a long time, and they do a great job. Now, the good news is, and we'll just knit this all tightly back in together, you have a home now. You have you're all better. And you're doing great, and being homeless is not the end of the world. It just feels like it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely hope.
Yeah. Mary, thank you so much. That's Mary Parks, a patient at Sadler who, when she lost all other access to health care, Sadler was there for her. We're hoping that everything goes well. We're going to keep trying. I tried to get a hold of folks at Sadler today to get them on the show, but it was obviously too short notice, and I imagine that their phone's been busy. But we'll try and follow up on this when we get back from Pittsburgh because, you know, that clinic is extremely important. And if 9,000 people in the area from Cumberland and Perry County don't have anywhere to get their health care taken care of, honestly, if it's just selfish, if it's just selfish that makes you make out a $50 check and send it to Sadler, think about the fact that those people who get sick are going to get you sick. You know, 90% of this stuff is communicable diseases. And if you don't mind the fact that the guy next to you doesn't have any access to health care, the guy next to you at the grocery store or at the restaurant or on the bus, you know, they're going to sneeze on you. So it's nice to have somebody have a place to go so that they can get healthy. However, if you're a humanitarian, then it's just nice overall. Anyway, I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk gun control. Coming right up.
We got a day.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crimes.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get a $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man
This is Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show. Rick's got the night. He doesn't have the night off. He's working in the other room. But we're off to Pittsburgh next week, so he's getting a whole pile of stuff done so that we can broadcast from Pittsburgh and tell you all about the AFL-CIO meetings that we're going to next week, and we'll have some great guests on. You're not going to want to miss it. Make sure you set your alarm clock if you're an early evening go-to-sleeper so you can wake up and hear the show. Otherwise, of course, there's a podcast. You can go to ricksmithshow.com. You can check out the podcast tomorrow. And if there's anything you heard that you want to hang on to, you can download that podcast and keep it, you know, share it with your friends on Facebook, all that other stuff. Show people you're cool. Right now I'm going to speak. I found a new website that I have bookmarked and saved and got to print out and put it under my pillow because I love what these guys are doing and what they're standing for. The Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Joining me right now, you Director of Communications, Ladd?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
Director of Communications, Ladd Everett from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. I'll tell you what, you got a graphic website, man. You just put it out there. And I don't think anybody should be allowed to vote without reading the details of what happened at Sandy Hook.
No, I totally agree. And I think, I think one of the tragedies of that, that terrible incident that occurred is that, you know, we didn't really look closely at what could have been done to prevent Adam Lanza from getting immediate access to all those types of firearms. You know, Connecticut did improve their gun laws, and they made some very important changes, but as we know, our federal Congress failed to act, and that must be corrected.
Oh, Connecticut, those hippies. What did they do to change their gun laws?
Well, Connecticut did a few different things. They toughened their assault weapons ban. They enacted some provisions that allow for interventions in cases where people are mentally ill and might have access to firearms. There were several changes along those lines that helped toughen laws that were good but not great.
Mm-hmm.
I think now Connecticut is moving on a very good path. And I think the laws they've enacted will save lives.
Yeah. Now, I've got a brother-in-law who, he's an MD, and he's a ton of fun. And he's taken me out back, and they've got, you know, they live up in Maine with, you know, 11 bajillion acres that nobody's in. And he's taught me how to shoot all his handguns and then make my own bullets and all that stuff, you know. Then we like chew rawhide, you know. But he doesn't have a 100-round clip automatic weapon that will take somebody's head off, which is virtually what happened at Sandy Hook, which is a detail nobody, other than your website, told anybody. The stories of the small children coming out that were still alive that were covered with shreds of other children's bodies. I mean, there were hundreds of casualties at that incident, not just the kids who died. You know, anyone who lived through that trauma must have been impacted for life. The kids have symptoms of PTSD now, and they sure will for a long time. What's the difference in the thinking between my brother-in-law, who I think is one of the greatest people alive, and the guy who has to have, you know, taped together all the clips so that he can have unlimited rounds at his disposal?
Well, I think your brother-in-law is probably far more typical of the average gun owner in this country. You know, I think one thing that we need to realize is that, you know, what we think of as the gun lobby or the pro-gun movement is really far more radical and extreme than the average gun owner.
Yeah, the average gun owner think that it's their 9mm that's going.
Yeah, you know, I would point, you know, you can look at past polling, like Frank Luntz, the famous Republican pollster, did a poll a few years back, and he polled NRA members and found that 3/4 of them supported universal background checks on all gun sales.
Huh.
You know, a policy which Wayne LaPierre and company fight tooth and nail.
Yeah.
So I think your brother-in-law is probably very typical of the average gun owner. He's a guy, and God bless him, that enjoys shooting, and that's fun for him. And he probably handles it very responsibly and at the same time has no problem, enduring minor inconveniences that will help us keep guns out of the wrong hands. And I think he's typical of most gun owners.
Yeah, I hope you're right because he's very rational. Like you said, you're 75% poll. He's like, no, I don't want people with the kid who shot up Virginia Tech, you know, had a history of mental illness. And the other problem, though, the other problem I have with that, having worked in the poverty world for a long, long time, that's my background, is the crazy people shooting people up don't, that history of mental illness thing, that doesn't indicate them, because there are people shooting people up that don't have a history of documented mental illness.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean,
like Fort Hood shooting from yesterday, which is what prompted my call to you, is two times in a row at Fort Hood.
Yeah, well, to be clear, this shooter did have a documented history of mental illness, although it's, you know, we're still very early in the fact-finding process here. Really understanding what he was going through. But I think you're making a larger point, which is very important, which is that, you know, the phrase crimes of passion exists for a reason. It's important to understand that the overwhelming majority of people who are dealing with mental health issues will never be violent toward others. That's a fact. We know that. You know, a lot of homicides that occur are indeed crimes of passion. They are incidents that arise from mundane arguments about things like money, relationships, property, you know, where people get heated in a given moment, have immediate access to a firearm, and tragedy occurs. You know, the issue of mental health, I think, is something where, you know, you have to have more targeted interventions that are really based on good research. Again, it's important to understand that most mentally ill people will never be violent toward others. The major problem in that area is actually the issue of suicide, not homicide. So, we've got a lot of good research in this area. The problem is we have not updated our gun laws in terms of who's prohibited from buying guns based on mental health reasons, literally since 1968. And we're letting a lot of good research sit on the table.
Yeah. We also have these really cool things that are now smaller than the size of four living rooms, and they're called computers, you know, which can keep a lot of information available. I mean, literally, I know this because I have no money. Right. I have no money. I have a tiny little credit card that I use occasionally. And, you know, if I buy a couple of things, it's maxed out. And if I go to buy the third thing, get one, it don't work. Because there's a computer that says, Pat LaMarche is broke. Do not let her have that $20 dinner tonight. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And why we don't have, with all of the computer efficiency we have. But see, this is the point. I think this is what frustrates me the most about people who support every gun, regardless of what, plastic guns on planes, fine. You know, no slippery slopes, please. We got to make sure you have every kind of possible gun possible, no matter what. Those people are the laziest members of a democracy I've ever heard of, because their justification for that is we might need to kill our government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I might have to march into motor vehicle and take out the lady who's supposed to register my car. Because my government is going to turn on me, and this is all I'm going to have. And that, and when you talk to a person who feels that way and you call them that, they get offended, which I find even funnier.
Yeah, no, I mean, you've hit on something that's incredibly important, which is really the foundational belief of the modern pro-gun movement is what you were alluding to. We call it the insurrectionist idea, and it's this incredibly perverted idea that, you know, there is an individual right under the Second Amendment, essentially to shoot and kill elected officials, police officers, military service members, you know, other government agents, when an individual believes that our government has become, quote-unquote, tyrannical. And it's absolute nonsense.
Right.
You know, one of the reasons the Constitution was enacted was to prevent that type of internal violent rebellion. You can think about Shays' Rebellion. That was a major factor that inspired the drafting of the Constitution. And the Constitution itself says in Article 1, Section 8, that the purpose of the militia is to suppress insurrections, not to foment them, to suppress them. And that's indeed what our founders did. So, you know, I think it's amazing to me how the pro-gun movement gets away with it, too. How you know, I think, you know, our organization and others are beginning to change that and build awareness of it, but it's just been remarkable how they're able to preach treason on a regular basis and portray that as patriotism. And, you know, we hope we've been able to shift that debate a little bit.
Thank you. That is the thing that absolutely blows my mind is, you know what, if you really are going to wait until that moment to become a patriot, when you could be voting, when you could be, you know, you could be taking lipstick and writing on a piece of cardboard and standing on a street corner, you know, you could be doing any number of things to participate in your government, and but you're going to wait until you've decided, like you said, that the IRS agent needs to go?
Yeah.
It just, I find it insulting to anybody who has half a brain to think that that is actually the reason that we need to have AK-47s.
Yeah, well, it's also important to understand that it reflects how little faith they have in the Constitution. I mean, think about it. If you think the only thing that's keeping democracy functioning in our country is your threat to shoot your elected official in the head, I mean, really, we're laughing about this, but think how little faith you must have in the work that our founders did in ratifying the Constitution.
Yeah.
You must have no faith in those checks and balances and our judiciary and even the Bill of Rights that you like to lecture us about, right? It's really remarkable.
And even if I'm like with the Supreme Court ruling recently that, you know, there's no limit anymore on whatever, I'm still like flabbergasted by that, but it doesn't stop me from trying to agitate to get things changed. It doesn't silence me to a point where I become murderous. I'm very excited to say, Ladd Everett from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, want to hear from people who disagree with you.
And sure, yeah.
Honest to God, I don't think they're going to call because people who disagree with you disagree with us and they don't listen anymore. But if there is somebody out there, and I did try to really hype this on Facebook that I had somebody who had guts coming on tonight to talk gun control. So give us a call, 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. Or you can email, Rick's here, so you can email Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Or you can just throw something up on my Facebook or the Rick Smith Show Facebook. If you'd like to weigh in or make a comment, if you're one of those people who's waiting for the day when you get to use your gun on your IRS agent so you're too chicken to use the phone, you can, you know, text me something and or put it on Facebook and I'll read for you. But Ladd is willing to, you know, let you have at him. This is your chance to have a voice in your democracy. 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. How pervasive, I mean, obviously the NRA now just found out, you know, the limit's off. Just keep buying politicians. Have a good time. Oh, Bill. Oh, I love Bill. Actually, we do have a person who's going to take great exception, I'm sure, to what you're saying, Ladd, and I got to give Bill credit. He's also courageous and a great listener. I enjoy talking to him. Bill, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Thank you, Pat. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Bill, Ladd, Bill. What would you like to tell him?
How are you, Bill? Well, you know, I think the general statement about people like myself who do believe in you know, our rights to own guns and are against the restrictions to a large degree. It's not about overthrowing the government or attacking officials. But I think in my own case, I need to tell you, a lot of members of my family come from the background of having, they were from Eastern Europe and they spent a lot of time in Stalin's gulags. In fact, some of them died there. And the one thing that I was aware of at a very young age was the first thing that happens in a tyranny is the restriction on the right to defend yourself. Now, you were making the point, and both you and Pat, that, you know, you need to be active and campaign against things you don't like and you know, discuss open discussions and legislate, you know, try to legislate for change and so forth. And I absolutely agree with you. However, I think both of you have to admit that our government, certainly within the last 20, 30 years, has done incredibly obnoxious things that we're against. I mean, Pat remembers I was agitated to stop that bombing on Syria.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're constantly
doing things. Do you think those things compare to what Adolf Hitler did?
People like me don't see our government as being responsive anymore. I mean, they really do what they want. And I personally, I believe they're totally owned by these corporations.
Good points, but let's let
Bill.
Mad.
Bill, do you think the behavior of our government is comparable to the Nazi regime?
No, but what I'm trying to tell you is the direction our government has taken, which is more and more, to me, reminiscent. And I do have a lot of knowledge of history, particularly that part of Europe. It's reminiscent of the step-by-step process, which eventually became flat-out tyranny. I don't see our government being responsive to we the people much at all anymore, especially we the people who are working class.
Okay, Lad?
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that. I'm not going to say democracy is perfect in this country. And I think our founders acknowledged that. You know, they said themselves when they gave us the Constitution, this is not a finished work. This is not a perfect work. There will be work for future generations to do. But, you know, so frequently in the pro-gun movement, I hear comparisons of our democratic form of government to the Hitler regime and to mm-hmm. Stalin's regime. And I just love America or I'm a super patriot, but I don't see that comparison.
Let me give you two words to ponder. Executive
okay.
orders.
Don't go away, Bill, yet, though. I just want to say that if you're fearing your government, I fear right now that my government doesn't have the kahunas to do something about people slaughtering people at Fort Hood or in Connecticut elementary schools or at university campuses. I wrote a column a number of years ago where the number of people dying on United States campuses exceeds the number of people dying in the Middle East from random bombings of buses and stuff. We are killing each other, and we have a government who's doing nothing about it. I completely understand what you're saying about coming from a place like that, but I know in my heart you can't be glad that these whack jobs have these guns.
I understand that there is a huge problem in respect to finding and identifying people that are unstable and shouldn't be anywhere near a plastic fork, let alone a gun. I fully understand that. But on the other hand, in a country of 310 million people, I'm not so sure the amount of violence we have is that great a number. I'm really not.
Oh, 35,000? Yeah.
It is. Our gun death rate is astronomically higher than any other high-income country.
Well,
our
car accident numbers are similar to Europe and Canada. Our gun numbers are, what, 350 times Canada?
Yeah, our gun death rate is astronomically higher than other high-income nations. And our overall homicide rate is far higher as well.
Our numbers are probably much higher than any country in Europe as far as drunk drivers, too. And that's just as much murder.
Not that I'm aware of. That might
gun.
Be the case, but have you seen evidence of that? I'm not aware that's the case.
I don't think the statistics are anything like what they are here in other countries as far as drunk driving deaths.
Trust me, there are a lot of drunks around the world.
Well, there's a lot of drunks here in Pennsylvania. I mean, this state is really bad, and they seem to keep wanting to pass laws to make the access to liquor on weekends and everything even more, you know? I mean,
yeah.
This is an argument that will go on and on and on, and there's never, you know, reasonable people are always going to disagree about it. I understand where Lad's coming from about people who are being unreasonably fanatic about this or that, you know, particular point. But I have very little faith in the system anymore as far as protecting us in any sense. I mean, two unreasonable wars with God only knows what the real numbers are as far as our own dead, let alone, you know, hundreds of thousands of innocent people in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it just seems it goes on and on and on.
Well,
right, but we still have the vote.
Well, but it doesn't do any good.
Well, you know, I'm, so you're making an excellent point now. We have had an administration and a half. The current one with drone bombing makes me crazy, too. But we had an administration, last administration, that literally murdered, in my opinion, 4,000-plus servicemen, as well as 250,000 Iraqis, as well as all of those Iraq and Afghanistan soldiers who are coming home impaired and killing themselves.
Absolutely.
And we, you didn't lift a gun to stop it.
Well, I'll tell you what.
I mean, all that. What are you going to do to protect? Are you going to use your gun to protect your country from?
I'm glad you brought that up, because let me tell you something on a personal level. I had dealings personally with a lot of returned veterans. I'm not going to go into the details of where I worked or any of that. There's no point in it. But I am telling you, the number of these guys that are coming back that have severe mental disturbances, it would scare you. It would really scare you. And I've even told people I know to keep their temper and everything under control, you know, in various incidents, whether they're driving or whatever, because you don't know how close the other guy is to snapping. And it's really a huge problem, and I don't see our government doing anything about it. These guys can't get their medication half the time, for crying out loud.
And shame on the United States of America, shame on the voters, shame on all of us. But the fact is, we're letting the United States, if you want to say we need to control our government, we haven't. And
no.
Bill, I'm going to thank you for calling in, because I've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to give those last few minutes to Ladd, but thank you for weighing in. I always respect your opinion on this, even though we will probably always disagree. But I did look up, real quick, Ladd, I looked up the statistics while we were talking on drunk driving, and it turns out that it's about universal. The drunk driving rates are about universal in Europe, the United States, and Canada. However, over the last 20 years, as all of the governments have made attempts to make them decline, the country that has brought the number of alcohol-related highway deaths down the most is Canada. So
there you go.
There's a little thing for your quiver. You got a minute left, Ladd. What would you like to leave people with as a message about gun violence in the United States?
Well, I think I take a more optimistic tack than Bill took a minute ago. You know, I think we do still have the power of the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think wringing our hands helps no matter what the problem is. And, you know, we all have issues that are of deep concern to us personally. In terms of gun violence, if it's important to us to change it, we can change it. If this Congress is not adequate to get the job done, and I think a lot of us probably feel this page at this point that that's the case, let's change our Congress. We have a big election coming up this November. Let's do that. Let's look into people's records on this issue and put the right people in those chambers.
And I'd like to say that if there's somebody out there that wants your vote that's taken NRA money, don't vote for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's everything that is going wrong here in terms of the people who are getting guns, why they're getting guns, we're the outlier here. We are the only democracy on the face of the earth that has not fixed this problem. It's not rocket science. The solutions are right there. Every other country has done this adequately and saved countless lives in the process. We are going to do so ourselves one day as well. How quickly we do that, you know, it simply is up to us. How much a priority is this to us? And are we willing to make this an issue and a priority issue when we go to the polls? And, you know, I would hope after the daily horrors that we see in this country, whether they're mass shootings or murder suicides involving families or
it's
accidental deaths in which a 2-year-old shoots a 4-year-old because an adult left a parent left a gun out on a coffee table. I hope people are sick enough of this at this point that they will do that.
Okay.
That they will make this a priority when they go to the polls.
Ladd Everett, Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Aggregate individual federal campaign contribution limits are gone thanks to Wednesday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling in McClutchin v. Federal Election Commission. The ruling dealt with direct contributions to candidates and campaigns from individuals and will likely increase the flow of money and its power in politics.
The High Court ruled that total limits of $48,600 every 2 years by individuals to all federal candidates and campaigns is unconstitutional, violating the First Amendment. Separate aggregate limits on political party committee campaigns were also struck down by the court. Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent said that this decision doesn't uphold, but in fact is a blow to the First Amendment and American democracy. Federal election law, still standing after this ruling, continues to ban direct corporate and union contributions to candidates. The limits struck down apply just to individual contributions. Chicago fast food workers protested McDonald's wage theft Wednesday at the McDonald's All-American game at the United Center. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago is fighting alongside the Fight for 15 campaign in an effort to raise wages for fast food and retail workers in Chicago. Three class action lawsuits in New York, Michigan, and California have been filed against McDonald's, alleging wage theft practices. McDonald's made nearly $5.6 billion in profits in 2013. Three Toyota plants in Ontario will be voting soon on whether or not to join Unifor, Canada's largest private sector union. The assembly plants in Woodstock and Cambridge, Ontario, would become the first Toyota union shops in North America if the union wins the vote scheduled for next week. Unifor, formed in August of 2013, is a merger of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and the Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union of Canada. SEIU 32BJ workers rallied in New York City Wednesday as 32,000 apartment building workers pursue a fair labor contract that maintains benefits while providing wage increases. A strike authorization vote was scheduled. The union, representing thousands of doormen, porters, and other New York City building workers, is ready to strike if talks with building owners break down. The current contract expires April 20th. A federal court challenge to Michigan's anti-union so-called right-to-work law will go ahead. The Michigan AFL-CIO will be allowed to make its case that the law violates the federal government's power to regulate private sector labor unions. U.S. District Judge Stephen Murphy ruled that the state does have the power to stop the union security clauses that allow unions to require workers covered by a collective bargaining agreement to either pay union dues or fees to the union. The Michigan AFL-CIO says the significant parts of the case challenging Michigan's right-to-work law are going forward. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is time, planets aligned and no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened the sleeping giants. Come on, now we can do it. We need to revive, re-up the labor movement.
Yeah, anything worth having is worth fighting for, unless you have to harm somebody else. I'm really against that. But I love that nonviolent stuff. You know, MLK Jr., who, by the way, tomorrow is the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Pick a moment in your day and have a moment of silence for what that meant to this country and what it should still mean to the country. I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith's got the night off. Well, that's a lie. He's in the other room working, but he's not hosting tonight. I'm hosting. Yay. I just want to say real quickly before we move on to our next guest that I love Bill. Bill is a regular caller to the show, and he always makes a lot of sense. And we got another little insight into why he feels the way he does about guns and gun control or why guns shouldn't be controlled. I'm sure Bill agrees. I am really upset that we haven't found a good way to control the United States of America's government. I'm really sorry that we don't have a way to control it. And like we spoke earlier about the economy, we don't have a better way to just make sure that people get a decent paycheck so that they can, at the end of the day, pay their own way and they can work a full-time job and actually provide for themselves and their families. That's what minimum wage should be. I'm sorry that we don't have a government that we can stop from drone bombing people at random. I'm sorry that we don't do something about that, and I think we should, but wait until the last minute when all that's left is, you know, locking and loading. That's not my idea of democracy, so we've got to find an in-between. And I think part of the way to find an in-between is to just realize that you're powerful. You are powerful. You are a powerful individual. You can help people in your neighborhood. You can help people in your town. You can help people on your street. You can help people at your church. You can help people at the school. You can help yourself. And people who realize that, they get going. They get stuff done. And that's my next guest, Tony Morgan, who pretty much has a fundraiser absolutely every month at his business because he believes he can make a difference. Hey, Tony, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Well, thank you very much, Pat.
You own, now, is it pronounced the Black Griffin?
Well, it's actually Black Griffin. It's the Welsh spelling and pronunciation.
Well, I was calling it the Black Griffin, but then I felt like the only person calling it that, so.
Well, you wouldn't be if you went to Wales with the word in your pocket and you gave it to a couple of Welsh people and they kind of scorned you for even asking.
Well.
That's Griffin. And okay,
Lord knows I live on scorn, so that would be nice.
Yeah, so do I. But that was one reason when I went to Wales why I took the word with me, because I wanted to make sure we were going to pronounce it correctly.
Now, the Black Griffin is in Elizabethtown.
Yes, it is.
Which is just a hop and a skip. If you head towards the airport, it's not far from there.
No, it is not.
And the food's fabulous. The owners are delightful people.
Well, good, because I'm one of them.
Thank you.
And my wife.
And your wonderful wife, who's also one of the most incredibly talented actresses and singers I've ever seen. She was in, for folks that were in Carlisle, went to the 9-to-5 show. She was the 9-to-5 working gal who had it going on. That was the part she played. I forget the name of the character.
Yeah, she does a lot of theater.
And that's how I met. Well, I was in the theater at 9-to-5, but I met you two personally because I was part of your Vagina Monologues production that you did a couple of months ago.
Yes, another fundraiser.
Yeah, and I learned at that you are just constantly doing that. And so we actually had on the woman who did Pets for Vets with you folks last month.
Susie Hamm, yes.
And so now you're doing another. Tell us what your next fundraiser is and what's going on and when is it? It's coming right up, isn't it?
Yes, it's actually going to be in a couple of Mondays. It's actually going to be April 14th at 6 p.m. This is something that, you know, we've done murder mysteries here in the past with friends of ours, with, of course, people that Lindsay has done shows with. We really love them because we get to act in them.
Ooh.
And so we get to be in character when all these customers and our regulars come in and then they try to call us by name. And, of course, we can just blow them off at that point in time because we're in character.
But they know that you are actors because they know you. You've got some ringers in this thing who could just be other customers, right?
Oh, they could be.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, you never know what's going on because, you know, and what's great, the way we love it and why we do them this way is actually we have a narrator, and that person, Ryan Boyles, who does a lot of them for us, he actually knows the whole story and reads it, kind of, and directs us. So we only know about who our character is and how we interact with the other characters.
So you don't know who did it either?
Murdered or get, you know, who's the murderer or anything. So a lot of it's very surprising to us.
Do you pretend that you know so people will buy you martinis?
Well, I don't know. We haven't had too many people buying me martinis.
Let me help you here. Pretend you know. Pretend that you can be bought.
Yes. Maybe I should. That's a good idea. I like that.
You're welcome.
I'm going to have to try it on this this one. And the reason why we chose to do this is actually one of our servers does these things for the March of Dimes with her mother. And we always do murder mysteries. We do them about twice a year. I know back a couple of summers ago we did one for Team Pink for breast cancer. With a local woman here in town. She was the one who actually did my wig for the Vagina Monologue.
Oh, that was lovely.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I loved it. So, you know, and when our server heard that we were doing this, she said, hey, well, you know, we always do this in the month of April. In the month of March, I'm sorry. And, you know, April. Jeez, I can't even get my months right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was wondering if, you know, maybe we can kind of tie it together. And, of course, you know, anytime anybody talks to us about a fundraiser, you know, our response is yes.
Okay, so we are going to talk about the fundraiser in a few minutes, but first of all, one thing I know from having been to a murder mystery weekend, which was really fun, is you don't even have to be doing a good thing. You don't even have to be, like, at the end of the day saying, wow, I did something nice for somebody else.
Sure.
Every single penny that they pay that will go to help the March of Dimes, that will just be a good time.
Yeah.
So that's what's really cool about murder mystery dinners is they are a blast.
Oh, we absolutely love doing them. We always end up, we'll do prizes for the top three detectives.
Is it going to work? Tell us what happens. People are going to come in. They have to make a reservation.
Yes, they have to make a reservation. We always do a dinner buffet. And the reason why we choose to do that is we usually start off with a soup salad, and then we can have a break where we can be doing some of the murder mystery stuff that we have to do as the narrator tells us to do it. And then we do the main dinner, and again, a small little break. and then the dessert. And we kind of tie it in so that you can come in, you're going to get fed. Obviously, it does include the non-alcoholic beverages as well. You know, obviously, alcoholic beverages we can't give away. The PLCB doesn't like that too much.
But you can purchase them.
Oh, yes. You know, the bar is completely open. It's like a regular day here, but we tell people when we open up the doors at 5:45 and you come in, the murder mystery is underway. And we are out here in character doing what we're supposed to be doing. And then, like I said, the narration starts probably around 6:15 or so. And, you know, it lasts a couple of hours. And there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of entertainment within these because for us, we don't know a lot of the action that's going to happen. We are being told what we're supposed to be doing. And then we have to do that. So the dude that comes in,
he's got the plan and nobody else has the plan. Is that how that works?
Oh yeah, he gets the full copy of the script. All we get is basically our suspect packet, and that just tells us who we are and how do we interact with the other suspects.
Oh, so everybody that comes in gets a suspect packet.
Well, the people that are acting in it.
Oh, okay.
The actual customers, they're all detectives that night. They actually get a little packet as well that includes some things. And what's really exciting about this one, and this is one of the reasons every April with the fundraiser, they actually do a scavenger hunt. Now, they're actually doing that scavenger, and she can talk about that a little bit more on the 12th. But what I love about this murder mystery, we searched it out, that this murder mystery actually, during the murder mystery, has a scavenger hunt for clues.
Oh.
So it's going to tie really nicely together. I'm actually really excited that we're going to get a little bit more, I think, crowd participation, which I really enjoy. We do get some because at different times the narrator will tell, you know, an actor, hey, you need to pick out somebody that you have a love affair with in the audience, you know. That's in the back room, and then all of a sudden you get to come out, and you got to select somebody.
Oh, fun.
You know, and they don't even know it yet. But and for our customers, they all know now. You know, we get a lot of repeat customers for the murder mystery because, like you were saying, they understand how much fun it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was at my murder mystery, which was in a really amazing bed and breakfast that had like 40 people staying there.
Oh, lovely.
And I didn't know who the actors were. Nobody knew who the actors were. We didn't know other people there, so we could have been the actors for all anyone knew.
Yes.
And I went back to my hotel room, to change or whatever because we were there for 3 days. And the murder weapon was on my bed. And I'm like, oh, crap, I'm the murderer, right? So I freaked out, and I took the murder weapon, and I was like a rat, you know, sliding up the inside of the walls of this bed and breakfast, really elegant place. And I found this window box and I hid the murder weapon there.
Oh.
So there was an afternoon like croquet match. And then there was a cocktail party. And then around the end of the cocktail party, some of the people from the place were like, oh, somebody was supposed to find the murder weapon by now. So it wasn't progressing. Because I had just, instead of playing along, completely ditched it.
like the murderer would.
Yeah. Oh, good point. But anyway, so I went, and we're all sitting there at dinner in this elegant place, and finally someone says, God, no, darn it, one of you people has the weapon. Where is it? So I snuck up, you know, after everybody else left and told them where they could find it. And they had to bury it again and hide it again. But it was really fun. And hopefully everybody that comes will have that same sort of guilty conscience that I did. And this will get even more squirrely and crazier and all that stuff. So it's a week from Monday night, which is
it's 14th. The 14th. Yes.
Okay, the day before income taxes due.
Yes, unfortunately, I guess.
Yeah, so that's a nice thing to do to take your mind off of things.
Sure.
And if you've already got your refund, you could go. So what we're going to do is I'm going to give you 30 seconds to tell us how wonderful your food is, and it is, and how really what a great place you have. And then we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Emily Stone, who's that employee of yours who wants to help little babies, and we're going to find out more about that. But real quickly, what would you say is the most wonderful thing about your restaurant?
Well, probably the most wonderful thing is basing it on the Welsh Foundation of using fresh local produce and products. And that has, since for the last 8 years, has really kind of set us in stone at really trying to help the local farmers and producers right here in the Elizabethtown, Lancaster County area. And like I said, you know, supporting the community, supporting our staff, and supporting our regular customers and all the new customers that we get throughout the year is very, very important to us.
How much is it next Monday night?
It's actually $30, and then part of that is being donated directly to March of Dimes.
And that
as well.
Also gets you your meal?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's $30 an individual, and you can come just one person. Like, I could just go by myself.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking I need to.
And, sure.
And then what do people do, call you and make a reservation?
Yeah, all they have to do is call us in at the restaurant.
The number?
And, make a reservation. They can even do it on our Facebook page at Black Gryphon. Contact us through the website as well. And, you know, just let us know how many people would be and how we can get a hold of you just to confirm. And then, yeah, once you have your reservation, that's basically your ticket.
Okay.
And like I said, when we open up the doors at 5:45 and you walk through that door, the game has begun.
Okay, so a phone number for folks to call and make a reservation?
It's 717-367-1859.
And your website?
Is www.blackgryphon84.com.
Okay, great. And would you put me down for two?
Oh, but of course.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and thank you, Tony. It's been wonderful to chat with you. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith, and this is The Rick Smith Show.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been covering military photographer Bill Jones and his mission to record damage at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The 20-year-old Jones was not in tune with the historical significance of what he had been ordered to do. But he figured out from his senior officers that it was a big enough deal that he should develop his own personal set of photographs, though he knew they were to receive a secret classification. Jones was concerned about getting his set of photos home without them being confiscated by someone. He solved that by wrapping his 8x10s covered with paper around the barrels of two souvenir Japanese rifles that were nailed shut in wooden boxes. He then put 4x5 photos in the bottom of an ammunition box and stuffed his girlfriend's letters on top of the photos and wired the box shut. So join us again next time to see what happens stateside. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. In the wake of another tragic shooting at Fort Hood, conservative pundits were quick to blame gun regulations and Democrats for not allowing soldiers to carry guns on military bases. On Fox & Friends, co-host Steve Ducey made this claim.
Now, keep in mind, it was back, I believe it was during the Bill Clinton administration, where they decided that men and women on base shouldn't be able to carry arms, even though they're trained professionals.
As the New Republic explained, it was a 1992 DOD directive issued under former President George H.W. Bush that established the rules limiting firearms on military bases. Bill Clinton didn't take office until January 1993. On Fox's America's News HQ, retired four-star general Jack Keane pushed back on that idea and explains why, in practice, arming servicemen and women on bases is not a good idea.
Can you imagine the first responders coming on a scene and there's people shooting all over the place and they have to determine who is friend and who is foe? The soldiers, they do know how to defend themselves, but they're not policemen. They are not trained to control a violent situation and de-escalate it.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
I'm
Scott LaMarche. This is the Rick Smith Show. Rick is taking the night off from on air, working behind the scenes, so don't say anything about it. We're talking about the Black Rifle and a special fundraiser they're having. It's a murder mystery dinner a week from Monday night on April the 14th. And it's going to be a blast because those things are a blast. Plus, the place has fabulous food, $30 a head if you want to go. And you don't have to be a couple. I mean, I'm going to try and see who wants to. I just made a reservation for two, but I'm going to have to beat the bushes to find somebody who wants to go with me. And go hang out. I mean, have a little fun, figure out what, who done it, and help some little babies. If you wonder where the March of Dimes came from, because I was, it was established by Franklin Delano Roosevelt to fight polio. As you know, Franklin Roosevelt had polio. And he started the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. That's where the funding came from, so that Jonas Salk could find the vaccine that eliminated polio pretty much in the United States, and now they're working on eliminating it worldwide. But there is a lot more that affects little babies, and so the March of Dimes continues. Joining me right now, Emily Stone, who works at the Black Rifle, where the event is going to be a week from Monday night. But, Emily, you have a special interest in the March of Dimes in particular, I hear.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
My mom's high school friend had a son born 26 weeks early. Born at 26 weeks premature.
Which is 14 weeks early.
Yeah.
It's pretty early.
Yeah, he was very, very small. But due to March of Dimes research, he did make it. He's now 7.
Wow.
And very healthy baby. I also had a baby as well, but due to March of Dimes research, they were able to hold off labor as well. So
you didn't go so early because of March of Dimes research that allowed you to carry the baby longer.
Yep.
Wow. So you have a personal reason for caring about this, and you went to your employers and you said, what, hey, I want to raise some money for March of Dimes, or what happened?
Yeah, well, Black Rifle's really big in doing a ton of fundraisers and raising money and giving back to everyone. And so this year my family was doing a scavenger hunt to raise money as well. So we had asked Black Rifle about doing something with us, and that's when we decided on the murder mystery.
Now, you said that you were doing a scavenger hunt. What does that mean? Do people participate in the scavenger hunt and they look for things all over town, or what is
that?
Yeah,
that actually is the Saturday before the murder mystery in Lancaster City. We'll be doing a scavenger hunt downtown all throughout the city with cash prizes.
What are you looking for? What's on the list of scavenged?
Some historic history about the city.
Oh, so you went around and you find the information, do you have to answer questions?
Yeah, you just, are we taking pictures, and different businesses will have answers to the questions and things like that.
Oh, that's fun. And how many people participate in that?
I think so far we have, 10 to 15 teams signed up.
10 to 15 teams?
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. And these people are going to be running all over Lancaster.
Yep, all over the Lancaster city.
Oh, Lancaster. I know. I say the word like I don't come from here, but I don't come from here. And at the end, they'll win prizes. They get cash prizes, or are the prizes donated from businesses?
First place is we're doing a $1,000 cash prize, which we were able to raise from local businesses.
Wow.
And then we also have prize baskets of things we've collected from different businesses as well.
So somebody gets some friends of theirs together. They go downtown. They hang out with a bunch of people. They run around town and learn information about where they live, and then they might get $1,000.
Yeah.
Wow. How much?
While helping a bunch of babies.
while helping a bunch of babies. How much do you expect to raise? Do you have any idea?
I'm not sure. I know last year we raised $3,000, so we're hoping to go above that.
That's great. Now, can people still sign up for the scavenger hunt?
Yeah.
And how do they do that?
We have a phone number you can call.
Give it to us.
Yep, it's 717-847-5066.
717-847-5066. 5066. And that's the number to be a part of the scavenger hunt the Saturday before. So that's the 12th?
Yep.
Okay. And then if you want to participate in the murder mystery, now, are you going to be waiting tables the night of the murder mystery? Or are you going to be one of the people that's actually possibly
murderer?
No,
actually, we'll be working.
Who's the victim, do you know?
I'm not sure. They don't tell me.
Will there be? I mean, will someone stand up and then like clutch their chest and then fall down and say, "Oh my God"?
I believe so. I mean,
Emily slipped me something. so that's kind of exciting. Have you done one of these before? Have you waited tables at one of these before?
No, I've helped with the other fundraisers we've done, but this will be my first murder mystery here.
I think it's exciting. I've participated in murder mysteries as a participant, and they're fun. Plus, you get to know people you don't really know because there are other people participating who are also trying to figure out who done it. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's going to definitely be a good time.
Now, how long have you worked at the Black Rifle?
I've been here since November.
Yeah, and you like it?
Yeah, I love it here.
This is your chance to tell whatever you want about Tony or...
I actually don't have a bad thing to say.
Isn't that great? Okay, so the food's great, the owners are great, the place is great, the wait staff is happy, they do wonderful things every month for the community, and they use local fresh produce that comes from Lancaster County.
Yep, and same with the meat as well.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. So that's a week from Monday night, the 14th of April. Sign up for the scavenger hunt at 717-847-5066. And anyone who wants to make a reservation to be a part of the murder mystery dinner, do you have that phone number handy, the phone number for the Black Rifle?
Yes.
Okay, what is that?
It is 717-367-1859.
Okay, well, good luck. Break a leg next 14th of April. I hope you guys have a wonderful smashing success and you make a ton of money for those little babies.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's Emily Stone, Emily, and then, of course, Tony Morgan before her, the owner of the Black Rifle. He and his wife, Leslie, are just fabulous people. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
The most important issues of the day. Hey, I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick. Rick's got the night off. Getting ready for our big trip to Pittsburgh next week. We cannot wait to get out there, and we're going to bring you great radio broadcasting from Pittsburgh. Two tickets to Pittsburgh. Anyway, right now, though, it's time for Talk Radio News Network, and with me right now is Justin Duckham. Hey, Justin, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, Pat, great to be here as always.
Yeah, nice to have you. I am so excited at this news about the, and I know this sounds creepy, but I'm excited because I want the truth. Senate panel has voted to declassify the CIA torture report. Does that mean it's going to happen, or does it have to go to the House?
No, this is only for the Senate panel alone, so it looks like it is going to happen. This was voted on by an 11-2-3 majority today with the Senate Intelligence Committee, rather. And, you know...
Wait. Three guys, I'm assuming they're men. Three people.
Correct.
Three people said, I'm on the Intelligence Committee, but I don't want to know.
Well, one of those, that is a very good point. One of those was Senator Marco Rubio, who, of course, is sort of acting in the whole 2016 persona right now. So he warned that releasing this to the public could create a situation where Americans could be killed, even though there's not really much evidence for that. So this looks like this is going to be slowly coming out. The CIA still has a
chance. I think we've proven that all people have to do to be killed, Americans need to do to be killed, is be at Fort Hood.
Oh, too soon. But, that is a good point.
We ought to be working on something a little different than keeping people from knowing the truth about what we do.
No, I absolutely agree with that point. That's always the argument that's sort of come up with these sort of ideas whenever somebody calls for more transparency. Initially, when WikiLeaks happened, the Pentagon was warning that, people on the ground in Afghanistan who are working with U.S. soldiers, were going to be killed. But at this time, we've never seen that actually materialize. So, these some concerns seems to be like a little bit more of the sort of crying wolf that we see from the intelligence community. But, of course, the CIA is still going to get a chance to redact certain portions of this report before it comes out. But it looks like the bulk of it, at least, the 3,600 pages, are going to be coming out. And these, give some pretty interesting insight into how the intelligence community worked during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, apparently detailing a good chunk of, torture and enhanced interrogation techniques, or as some people call it, that, are now proven to have taken place and possibly broken the law.
I was just going to say, first of all, to use the line they use on us when they spy on us, well, if you got nothing to hide, why do you care? Right? I mean, isn't that what we're... the fact that they know how many pizzas I delivered last or ordered last year, I mean, so if they've got nothing to hide, why are they so upset about having to release it? A, right? And then B, my question is... by the way, I don't believe that for private individuals, though. But B, my question is this going to have anything or tell us anything about rendition or moving people to other countries where, torturing and killing was kind of wink, wink, thanks for helping us out stuff?
I'm not exactly positive if this is going to discuss rendition itself. Of course, this is going to be going into some of the harsh interrogation techniques. And perhaps even more interestingly, it also shows that Congress sort of lied to Congress when they said that these methods were, in fact, effective. They pointed out that a number of the things that they put forward, could have actually been obtained without using enhanced interrogation. It points out that in some situations... detainees, whatever the word that we're using these days, gave information for, upcoming attacks or gave the information necessary, and then were still subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques afterwards, even after they'd given up the information.
What? Wait. I thought you were going to tell me that they gave stuff that was false just to get them to stop beating on them, but you're saying that they gave they coughed it up and then they continued to torture them.
That's what it looks like. That's what was one of the details that is apparently laid out in the report, according to some early analysis that we've seen through several media outlets. So this is a pretty damning report. The CIA is disagreeing with a lot of portions of it. Of course, the parts where they are accused of lying to the American Congress, and it's also worth looking at the context that this release is happening in. This is going on right now between a very heavy schism between the CIA and the Senate. Initially, a lot of these documents that were included in the Senate thing, the CIA said were actually stolen by committee staffers who apparently don't really have much computer training, and so the idea of them hacking into super-secret CIA computers is a little bit laughable. And that's sort of the melodrama going on behind the scenes of this release. There's a lot of tension right now between Dianne Feinstein and the agency specifically, with her, of course, accusing the agency, and actually now it's been essentially proven that the agency did hack into committee computers to try to figure out how they got details of this report, which, according to Feinstein, were given to the committee by the CIA themselves. So it looks like there may have been a little bit of ineptness along with just basic poor behavior here.
You know, I think it would be really wise for who's ever running the CIA now. I'm sure it's not a Bush family member anymore. but whoever's running the CIA might want to stop taking cues from, like, Schwarzenegger. You know, he wasn't really in the CIA. He's just an actor. But when he made up all those stories about how he was a victim of the maid he impregnated, you know, this is that kind of argument. Oh, look, they got our stuff without, oh, you're the CIA. You're supposed to be able to take care of that junk.
No, exactly. And, you know, apparently what happened here was, they were giving over a database of documents that the committee could go through. And somehow the super secret documents that they did not want to be included in there were put in there, either by a whistleblower trying to reveal it to the Senate or just as a major screw-up on behalf of the agency itself. So it's pretty interesting to speculate, why they're so offended that these documents were released when it turns out that it came directly from the CIA itself.
It's comical that they're worried about somebody getting killed if this stuff comes out when they obviously aren't too worried about it when they're, like, putting their regular stuff in with the super-secret documents.
That's a very good point.
Okay. So the House Oversight Committee, moving from the Senate to the House, they're talking about a contempt vote for Lerner, the IRS chief who's unwilling to chit-chat. She's knows how to keep a secret, I guess, or is trying to. What's up with that?
So initially when she was first called before Congress, she gave an opening statement. Then in her two additional appearances, she pled the fifth. And the House Republicans are trying to claim that since she made an opening statement, she thereby waived her right to plead the Fifth Amendment, even though typically that's been something that's been enshrined in the Constitution. So now they are threatening to hold her in contempt of Congress. This is going to first start off with a committee vote that's going to take place next Thursday, and then if that's successful, it will go to the House itself. It's worth noting that they are always very eager to do these sort of grandiose gestures. This is the same committee that went after Holder for the entirely false Fast and Furious scandal. Mm-hmm. And it's also, worth noting that this entire IRS scandal in the first place is just sort of a dud. We now have enough information to know that, liberal groups were targeted as well, and that this was not some sort of epic attack on behalf of the administration against the, Tea Party. So,
I did the unthinkable, and I read what Fox News was saying about it.
Oh, my, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I did wash my eyes out, though, so I'm better now. But they don't know that anything else happened. The Fox News people, they don't know that liberal groups were targeted, too. It's fascinating when you read their website, which probably the people that listen don't read, so they must have read it to them, too. But, I mean, that whole people who listen to Fox News know less than people who don't have news at all.
Hmm.
I'm
actually, in full disclosure, I am a Fox News contributor, so I'm not going to diss my network, so I apologize.
Well, and I apologize if I've disparaged you.
Agree to disagree on that fact. No,
okay,
that's right.
Perfect. And I will move right along, although it will be a little tougher now because I have my toe in my mouth.
You should see my family at Christmas time.
I bet it's amazing.
I come from California, so I get the third degree pretty frequently.
Wow. House votes to redefine full-time workers under Obamacare. So are they going to say all workers are full-time now so people stop getting fired, or what's the deal?
So essentially under Obamacare, a full-time worker was considered somebody who worked about 30 hours per week, was considered to be a full-time employee. And under Obamacare, if a company has more than 50 employees, they are therefore required to give, health insurance. So the Republican argument for this is that by changing it to 40 weeks, we're not going to see businesses try to cut people's hours in order to skirt that law.
But at the same time, we're also creating a situation where a lot more companies are not going to have to give people health insurance in the first place. So this is all just sort of a way to, let businesses that seem to be doing pretty well, if they're, thriving in an economic environment, can hire this many people giving health insurance to the people who they support. So this is the 52nd time that Republicans have voted to, undermine the Affordable Care Act. And it's a little interesting this time around. It looks like 18 Democrats actually crossed the aisle to support this. So there we go.
This is falling on deaf ears for the general government anyway, but certainly people who feel this way don't get listened to, I guess. But having this tied to employment is so stupid. And it's just been going on ever since World War II, and it's just stupid. And so it's so frustrating. It just makes me nuts because there's absolutely no reason that there are models all around the world that work better where the people live longer and pay less, and we can't copy one of them,
No, exactly. I mean, it seems to be an incredibly kind of arbitrary distinction that you get insurance simply via employment. Instead of, through the single-payer system, which, as you mentioned, has been pretty successful elsewhere on the planet. But, we are America, so we have ruled that out a long time ago and, won't even touch anything like a middling public option. So yay cowardice.
Yeah, I was a history major in college and grad school. So when the people came back from World War II, there was a hiring freeze. They couldn't hire, a wage freeze. They couldn't raise wages because they were worried about inflation. So they wooed the best workers by giving them health insurance, which was fairly new. Penicillin hadn't even been invented until 1932. So here it is, 45. And, they finally stopped using leeches, and health care seems like a good thing to have. And so it was the little carrot they used to get people to go to work for them. But that...
Oh.
That's where it comes from, by the way. So you couldn't give somebody a raise, but you could offer them health care at a time when health care was not universal anyway. Within 5 years, though, the UK and France and other countries who said, we're going to care about each other, just made it like education, public education. Everybody gets it.
Right.
So anyway, that's if you ever play trivia, go out, and play a trivia game, maybe you can win a
that's really good to know, actually. I appreciate that. That's an excellent factoid.
My pleasure. Hey, Justin Duckham, thanks so much for taking the time tonight.
Hey, thank you so much, Pat. You have a great evening.
You too. I'm Pat LaMarshall, and I'm for Rick Smith. Oh, my God, Justin. I'm sorry about that, about Fox News, but I mean it about all the rest of them. I'm Pat LaMarshall, and I'm for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
For and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get an $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
You're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. When the climate changed about man-made global warming in this country, and everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem, I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
My only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end.
Well, that's an uplifting kind of happy moment. It is climate science, and it's political science, and it's important to know your sciences, especially important. And you know, my problem with the people in the United States of America is they all think that Captain Kirk is like going to come and bring a couple of whales from the past, go back in the past, grab a couple of whales, invent synthetic aluminum or whatever, transparent aluminum, and save the day. And that's not going to happen. You got to save the day yourself. Do you know that China has outstripped us by like 400% in renewable solar and wind power? Like they're dying. They're dropping like flies in China because of air pollution, but they're also way ahead of us. We lost 700,000 people last year because of air pollution, contributing to their deaths. So, you know, we got to wake up and start paying attention. But China's doing it. People are investing money all over the globe in it. And what's his name? Warren Buffett, all down on it. So we got to start doing this stuff, smarter stuff. That's the way to build jobs, make jobs, build component parts for windmills, for photovoltaic stuff. And when you go in the Midwest and then out in the far west part of the United States, everybody's got a carport that can. Why is there not a solar panel on every carport? Why the heck don't we shade the highway? Just the highway goes through the desert, and nobody wants to shade the desert because there are ecosystems that live in the desert. But you could shade the highway. Then you'd drive in the highway. You'd be in the shade. It would be so much more pleasant. We'd save all that money on air conditioning. And you'd have, like, thousands of miles of solar panels. Let's do something smart. Unlike James Franco. You know, I'm going to be in New York City in a couple of weeks. I'm going up there to speak at Columbia. And when I'm up there, I'm going to get to go see Of Mice and Men. Steinbeck, one of my favorite authors of all time. And so I'm going to be there where James Franco is right now playing in New York City in the play Of Mice and Men. And he got himself in a little bit of trouble last night or the night before because a 17-year-old girl visiting from Scotland sort of, you know, did one of those selfies with him on a video. And she posted it on Instagram or something. Well, I don't understand computer stuff. Anyway, she did something that made it kind of public. And James Franco, who's 35 years old, kind of starts hitting on this 17-year-old girl. And he hits on her and hits on her and hits on her, and I guess the Instagram became private. Or so James Franco thought. But if you're going to hit on a 17-year-old girl and you're like, don't want to be a creepy old man, first of all, don't hit on a 17-year-old girl. But think about the fact that she's 17. That means she's too young for you in a lot of ways. In fact, she's too young for you in the fact that she will make your correspondence public, which is what this 17-year-old girl did. 35-year-old James Franco is now looking like a creepy older dude. Where are you staying? What's your phone number? Blah, blah, blah. How can I come see you? Do you have a little bit of time? Obviously, she's going back to Scotland, so it doesn't appear that he was trying to look for some sort of a long-term relationship. He just wanted to, he just wanted to spend a little time with her. Well, now James Franco's got a terrible reputation, which, yeah, I'm thinking he's probably not going to live down. Mitch McConnell, he says that all those Kentuckians are just going to admit to the Affordable Care Act catastrophe. He's going to get landslide reelected. They're going to just tell him how much they love him because the Affordable Care Act is a catastrophe. However, the statistics are in, and because of Obamacare, 360,000 Kentuckians now have health insurance. That eliminates 40% of the uninsured in Kentucky. 75% of them, 270,000 people, had never had insurance or were previously uninsured. They might have had it back in the day, but they did not have it at the time. That means that the uninsured population in Kentucky has been reduced by 42%. Now, if that 42% vote, guess what, Mitch McConnell? They might not think that you're so keen anymore. So maybe you better get on the bandwagon of the Affordable Care Act or stop talking trash about it. There's a cleanup company that's warning right now that parts of North Dakota should just become radioactive waste sites or will be radioactive waste sites if something isn't done. A national radioactive waste cleanup company put out a warning to North Dakota oil producers. And if you know, it's like everybody with a backyard has got an oil well now in North Dakota. I don't know if you're aware of that. Joe Weissman, a radiological operations manager for U.S. Ecology, told the Bismarck Tribune that the oil boom in North Dakota's Bakken Shale is unintentionally causing more instances of illegal dumping of oil-related waste, much of which is radioactive. Weissman cited two recent discoveries of radioactive oil filter socks, one time hoarded in an abundant gas station in a little town called Noonan, and that stuff, waste is just spilling off of trailers, falling out of trailers outside of Watford City. Never heard of these places, and I guess you never will if they continue leaving this radioactive waste because it's going to make these places uninhabitable. The dumping of oil socks, those are radioactive nets that strain liquids during the oil production process, could result in extremely expensive cleanups from the Environmental Protection Agency. You know what that means? That means the rest of us taxpayers are going to end up paying to clean up this mess that oil companies are making obscene profits on. Wake up! Wake up. This is crazy. It's time to do something that's sensible. And this is not it. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, the Navy's going to have a brand new destroyer. Well, you know, we got to make those military-industrial complex weapons because the military-industrial complex has to make money because they own our government and they just channel that through. But this particular new destroyer doesn't have any people on it. The new U.S. Navy is going to christen a new class of destroyer, and it is a drone. The USS Zumwalt has cannons that fire rocket-propelled GPS-guided rounds and has a stealth design that gives the 610-foot ship the same radar signal as a small fishing boat. There's also a computer intelligence capable of preparing the ship for battle and engaging targets. Guess what? All by itself. This is that, what was that movie that, was it Matthew Broderick was a little kid? Is that who was in it? The movie where back when they had nuclear missiles up in the northern part of Maine, that just starts launching the missiles sort of, accidentally. He's playing a game. It's War Games or something? Something like that. Anyway, that's what this sounds like. This ship, is anyone thinking that, like, wait a minute, the Zumwalt is a Raytheon product. It also made most of the ship, all of the ships on board computer systems. Raytheon says that most drones, the air-based drones, are a couple of million dollars. This drone is costing $5 billion for a ship that can wage war, go into battle on its own. Unlike aerial drones, the Zumwalt could still have a human crew, and it will know how to anticipate the human crew's needs. If the ship's smoke alarms or cameras detect a fire, the ship will turn on the sprinklers and seal off the area. Like how? Hi, Dave. What are you doing? Why are you dismantling me, Dave? Daisy, Dave. Remember? Remember 2001? Yeah. When the fire is out, the ship knows to drain the water, and then it will allow the crew to investigate the fire. All of this automation means that the ship will carry a crew as small as 150 people, half of what is normally required to keep a ship of that size. However, it's not necessary that it has 150 people. It could have 40 people. The Zumwalt says that Raytheon, what Raytheon calls a total ship computing environment, which allows it to be controlled from any of a couple of dozen consoles around the ship. That's why you only need 40 people. I don't know. Why are we putting all this money into weapons? We just talked tonight about the fact that the UN has said that we have gone way by red alert status for the environment. Climate change is a complete game changer now. It's going to acidify our oceans, killing fish and sea life, including sea plants. It's going to kill land-based vegetation. Floods, superstorm Sandys, all this stuff. We've got all these problems to solve. Why is Raytheon putting all its energy into making a stealth destroyer drone when it could be putting its energy into helping us solve climate change? I'm not saying we couldn't have a Captain Kirk, but we're not working on getting one. We're not working on finding a single solution that would actually get us closer to eliminating these problems. It's remarkable. And then last tonight, I'm a Red Sox fan. I also love, though, the Baltimore Orioles. And I know, well, I've, the Phillies. I like the Phillies, too. I like baseball. But I'm from New England. My one true love, the Boston Red Sox. Of course, I loved them when they were losers. So now people love them because they're winners. But most of my life, they were cursed by Babe Ruth, and that was the end of it. I did go to an Orioles game, though, a year or so ago. Maybe it was 2 years ago, and I got to see Big Papi, David Ortiz, come up out of the dugout. The seats were amazing. Seats like that in Fenway would have been $500. These were like $69 or something. They were just fabulous seats. And Big Papi comes up out of the dugout to get up and play, and my God, he like blocked the sun. He was half of the infield, just a giant, giant guy. And that Orioles, Camden Yards Stadium is fantastic. Anyway, so the Red Sox go to the White House, right, to celebrate their 2013 World Series win. David Ortiz snaps a selfie with the president and sells it to Verizon, or one of those phone companies. Anyway, you can look it up online. I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith will be back here tomorrow night. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick at therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial Mysterio.